takes on.
I'd like to call the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting to order. Good morning, everyone. Let the record show that we have a quorum present for the meeting. Members, I trust you have the packet in front of you, which has today's agenda. We have a business meeting this morning that will run till about 11 o'clock. At 11 o'clock, we'll have a bit of an overview about our field tour, which will be in the southern metropolitan area. And the field tour will leave here. Bill can give us details just a bit about travel arrangements for that field tour. And we will be returning back here to the state office building. The agenda says 5:30, but I think we're going to see if we can't get that closer to 5 o'clock. I know that Senator Anderson and a few others have some commitments. I think we're going to see if we can make it back to St. Paul here at 5 o'clock. Members, with that, the business items on the agenda, we are going to have a discussion from the Department of Agriculture on the Emerald Ash Borer quarterly status report. Recall this report is required to be prepared quarterly by the Department of Ag, so they're going to present that. The draft of that report is Bill handed out. It was not in your packet, but it was just laid on top of the packet here just a few minutes ago. And then we're going to have a discussion from the Department of Natural Resources on the Conservation Partners Grant Program. And then as part of that discussion, we are going to have the native seed growers are going to be discussing issues that they're running into regarding some of the legislation requiring sourcing of seed. And then we'll have at the end, right before the end of our business meeting, public comments. And again, this is the last meeting we have before we start moving into some decisions about allocations for the next round of funding. If you look at your schedule, our next meeting we have will be on the 12th of November, and that is going to be a meeting where we will select a subset of the proposals that we receive to be heard. And those hearings will be on the 23rd of November and then on the 8th and the 9th of December. We will have an allocation meeting on the 15th of December, and then just looking ahead into early January, January 7th, we'll, as we did last year, Bill will put together a draft appropriations bill with rider language and so forth. We'll review that and hopefully adopt our recommended package for fiscal year 2011 funding to the legislature on that date. And then beyond that, we don't anticipate any meetings during the session, but we'll hold that open to see how things go. But right now the plan is after we make our recommendations, the council would not be formally meeting until after adjournment, and that will be on the 26th of May. But again, we'll reserve judgment in case there is a need for the council to get together in short order. Members, with that is the agenda. Motion to adopt the agenda as proposed.
So moved.
Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion adopted. Meeting minutes from our meeting in September 15th and 16th. Hope you all had a chance to look at that meeting, those meeting minutes. Bill indicated there's a bit of a revision. If you look at the document in front of you, the one revision on page 3, which is the last sentence, was omitted from the original meeting minutes, and it says now the council unanimously adopted this call for funding request. So that's the one change that is in the meeting minutes that's different from what you saw originally in the original document. Motion to adopt the meeting minutes. from September 15th and 16th. Any further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting minutes are adopted. Bill, Executive Director, report.
Well, I'd like to start out with progress on personnel. And we've asked our new administrative assistant, Sandy Smith, would you stand up to come today to say hello? And Sandy is out of Minsky, the Minnesota State College and University System. She's been there for the last 6 years?
Four years.
Prior to that, she was 6 years with LCMR. Prior to that, she was with the City of Lauderdale and the City of Maplewood, and spent a short stint of time as the City of Lauderdale's, what was the position?
Interim administrator.
Interim administrator. So she brings a wealth of talent and an understanding of the legislative process, the systems that we use, things of that sort, and the council process. And can we give her a round of applause and welcome?
So, Sandy, again, on behalf of the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, welcome, and we look forward to having you starting, which is a week from today, correct?
Yeah.
Great.
We have an open position that's being advertised that we propose this week for a program analyst, project analyst, excuse me. Someone with planning skills as well as analytical skills, understanding the legislative process and that sort of thing. We will go through the normal Legislative Coordinating Commission hiring process, which is a initial vetting for the purposes of ensuring that the person is nonpartisan as well as the quality of the individual. And then the director and the LCC director will do the final interview. Mike wanted me to talk a little bit about my schedule, what I've been doing, and what's coming up. Just so you all know, last week I spent Thursday with the road right-of-way officials in the state of Minnesota. These are the people that buy land, generally for the counties and local units of government, to talk a little bit about the history of the council and the council going forward. We had 225 people at the conference. Our session was had 50 or 60 of them. We had a 50-minute presentation, some very good questions. It was a valuable group to talk to. They go back to the counties, the cities, and that sort of thing, and can carry the message back for us. And we talked about the council, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and the small grants program. Other things that I've been doing, I was up in Duluth 2 weeks ago to meet with the city, St. Louis River Citizen Action Committee. They requested a meeting in order to understand the fact why their last proposal didn't fare as well as they had hoped it would, and how to improve it. We spent about 3 hours discussing what they were doing in terms of restoration of the St. Louis River estuary, who was involved, and the PCA, the DNR, local municipal government are all involved, and gave them some tips on preparing their request to you. Likewise, with the Renville County on a request for acquisition of a program to acquire specific sorts of property along the Minnesota River. Next week, I'm going up to Beltrami to visit with the CONCON Joint Powers Board. This will be an interesting meeting, but I think it's important to bring the message to them that we're here and we're doing our best to acquire land in a sensible fashion and to use other ways to protect property and to restore and enhance it. About, what was it, 3 weeks ago, Mike?
Mm-hmm.
3 weeks ago, Mike and I went up to Grand Rapids at the request of the Nature Conservancy, and the council was awarded the legislative award for the Nature Conservancy in Minnesota. And I'm passing that around because really a nice opportunity for the council to get to meet the people who are movers and shakers in the Conservancy and to thank them for their help as well. Going forward, Mike has gone over the agenda pretty high level. I wanted to talk a little bit about what's going to happen between the receipt of requests on November the 2nd and the selection of requests on November the 12th. And the period for submitting closes at 5 p.m. November the 2nd. Sandy and I will, by the 4th of November, accumulate all of the requests into a single document, get copies made, hard copies for you, along with a summary sheet and a scoring sheet I'll discuss later, and FedEx those out to you on November the 4th. You'll be able to look through the requests, and we are going to ask you to score them as follows. And the purpose of this scoring is to get a sense of which projects you might want to hear. It's not an allocation scoring or anything like that. First of all, does it meet the minimum criteria? That's, I believe, there are 19 or 20 minimum criteria. If no, no further scoring is required for the proposal from you. And that, in other words, you're giving it a zero for any further scoring. If yes, then we'll ask you to do two things. On the statewide priorities, give it a 1 to 5 score. And then on the regions that it applies to, give it a 1 to 5 score on those regional priorities. Sandy and I will accumulate those. They'll need to be back to us somewhere around the 9th of November. We'll accumulate, average, and put the proposals in order of score. And on the 12th of November, after discussions with the chair, essentially what will be before the council is inherently a motion to hear the top 48. And then it's the order of work is to substitute or we actually have a little bit of time we could add, but preferably substitute proposals that you wouldn't want to hear that are below the top 48 on a motion-by-motion basis. Does that make sense to folks?
So members, I'm sorry, Ellen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to clarify the date that we were going to get. You said the 4th would be FedEx to us, and when would you want it back? I just want to put that time, that date on my calendar.
November 9th.
Okay.
By the close of business, November 9th, so we have the 10th and 11th to massage it.
And that assumes that we have 48 proposals we want to hear. And we may find that as we look through them, we have 12. Or whatever, but our upper bound is 48 proposals.
So, any other questions on? Sir?
How are the proposals coming in? Are they?
You mean in what volume? I haven't seen any yet, but I have to admit that only last Friday did I get out coming into. My guess is we'll have a few more than last time, about the same number, which was in the 89 area. Our criteria, I think, are helping a little bit. People are paying attention to them, which is important, and it may lessen our job. I think we've got some work to do to understand our criteria and priorities as we go through these proposals. What we communicated to people. But I'm anticipating about the same number.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that in the LCCMR, we had the largest amount of requests that we've had in years this year. And it was about twice as many as in the previous year in terms of number of requests, and the dollar amount was about 10 times the amount of money we had. And I don't know exactly what the reason for that is, but I suspect there's more awareness and visibility of these funds in general. So beware. It may happen to us as well. I don't know.
And I'm,
Mr. Chair, yeah, Bill, please.
And I'm not certain right now what we do if that happens. Hopefully our priorities work.
Are you getting, Bill, a lot of inquiries?
A couple of that, I think, is the best way to explain it. And some we've seen before, some are new, so there's a good mix. So that's, my sense is it'll be about the same, but the Senator's caution is well placed. Hopefully they all apply to LCCM.
Yeah. And since we funded every single one of them, they won't come back, right?
Right.
Right. Can an entity submit exactly the same application to both funding sources?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no...
And the applications are slightly different. The same project can be...
How will we know... How will you know that one project didn't get double funded?
What's the double funding?
I'm saying we approved the project for funding, and they in turn... They're not telling us what every project they funded.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we just finished. We're just about a month ahead of Sergeant Sam. So LCCMR just passed our preliminary package last week. I mean, it's preliminary, but it's done. It's a done deal, and it has to have final vote in a week or so, but that's probably formality. So we do know. And we talked a lot about this during the process in the LCCMR about, you know, we considered doing some challenge grants and saying, we'll fund this if Lasard Sands matches it. And we couldn't quite figure out how to do that, so we didn't exactly do that. But there are a couple of projects where it makes sense to both look at them. So we'll get to that.
And Ellen, in round numbers, how many proposals did LCCMR receive?
Well, I know it was about $240 million in requests for $24 million. I can't remember the number. Either of you remember?
238.
Pardon?
238.
Over
200.
238
proposals.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And how many did we end up? We added 2 days of hearings.
48.
We funded 48?
Recommended 48.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. Okay, Bill. Any other questions? Great. Yeah.
A question on a different subject rather than the actual application back to the plaque. Is it my understanding that UPM Kimini has attempted to sell the land where this Upper Mississippi River project was occurring?
I don't know that as a fact. There is rumor that they plan to, but that's a speculative rumor.
And, Mr. Chair, if that sale would occur before funds are transferred, we have a lag here in terms of the money coming in. What is the procedures for tracking that?
Well, Rick, I guess I would defer to folks who are legal counsel, particularly as it relates to real estate, but my understanding is the option has been signed, and so regardless of the disposition of that land now, that easement goes with the land and not the owner. So if they were to sell it tomorrow, the terms of the easement as negotiated by the state go with the property.
The only thing that could stop that is the failure of the state to issue the option exercise letter. Exercise the option is my understanding.
They know one of the people that's bidding on the land, and they're only interested in it if it has the easement on it.
Wes, did you have...
Just a quick one, Bill. We talked a little bit about logistically and getting the requests out. I consider this extremely important, and we will have people in the Northwoods area quite deeply. I'll find out who the delivery system is to the hunting cabin up there, so I'll let you know.
I appreciate it. And
Mr. Chair,
the last thing I'd like to go over very quickly is the tour. And Mike has gone over most of the specifics. We are going to be looking at Vermilion Highlands, the Vermilion River area wetlands, Minnesota River and the Mississippi River. The individuals who prepared this tour for us at our request are the DNR Central Region, Board of Water and Soil Resources, Dakota County, and Dakota County Soil and Water Conservation District. And they've been spending about 2.5 weeks working on this. They've been kept apprised of everybody's time constraints, restraints, whatever you want to call them. I think we'll, barring an accident on the freeway, we'll get us back in time. So I wasn't inferring that we would be in the accident.
This is a first-rate operation. We don't get second-class drivers.
I feel really confident.
So there are 20 seats on the bus. I've got 20 passengers and 20 lunches that will be delivered shortly before we leave at 11 o'clock. So with that, Mike, that's the executive director's
report. Yeah, and I guess just for the benefit of those of you in the audience who want to participate, certainly you're welcome to. The bus will be leaving outside in the front steps of the state office building. It's a small, kind of a mini bus, 20-seater. And about what time, Bill, would you think the bus will actually be departing the state office building?
Probably 11:15, 11:30.
So you're certainly welcome to join us and just kind of line up behind the bus, and we'll be leaving about 11:15, 11:20. Yeah, and there's information about the tour out on the table. Just one other thing that's probably worth noting, Bill. You and I had a meeting a couple weeks ago with the legislative auditor, and you might want to just talk about what was discussed. There were two meetings. You were involved in one, and I was involved with you in another.
Right. We have discussed the legislative auditor's role in the biennial audit, and Jim Nobles, the auditor, will be getting back to us with a letter indicating what he needs to do and an indication of how much money it's going to cost. I think it's incumbent on us to provide those funds. And it's not a significant... Well, it's a significant amount in my pocketbook, but I think it's around $65,000. The other meeting we had was with regard to the auditor's study of management of state land. It was an interesting discussion. The things that we covered included PILT, state management of land. What else, Mike?
Those are the two big ones, and just as it relates to the constitutional uses of the fund.
Right. And these are extremely talented people, and they're doing a very good job. And it'll be interesting to see their report, and it'll provide good guidance for us. I want to say that working in the executive branch, I always found the auditor's reports on the programs that we were running to be extraordinarily helpful in improving the programs. And it's an opportunity to get some insight from some very intelligent people about how things are going and to make things better. It's sort of in that vein of good, better, best. Do not let it rest until the good is better and the better is the best. And this is a way to improve things.
Les.
Mr. Chair, Bill, did you have the local government units, especially the counties, represented in the meeting?
Les, the way it works is the legislative auditor calls the meeting, but I have no doubt from my discussions that they talked with counties, not all counties, but I know that they talked to local units ago.
Yeah, in fact, they did mention in the meeting they had met with some of the county folks, Association of Counties, I believe. Any other questions of Bill regarding his activities? And I don't know if everyone is aware, but Bill's office now is just around the corner. His and Sandy's office in room
95.
So this will be added to the wall, and he's starting to get the office looking a little bit more less sparse.
We appreciate everyone who's loaning things to the state.
What do you mean?
Right now, maybe some modern art. I don't know.
Next item on the agenda, thank you, Bill, is the treasurer's report. Dave, you want to give us an update?
Sure. You have in your packet this report from the Management Budget Office. The second line of the chart is really the part that's pertinent to us, which is the sales tax revenue. We're expecting around $70 million this year has been our plan, less the $18 million that's allocated for the Forest Legacy easement, leaving us about $52 million. What this says is that of that $52 million, and we used 50 as a number when we were putting together the RFP, that this was revenue was off 2.3% in the first quarter. So the $50 million is a reasonable number. I guess that's the deal. It's early. To be sure, we'll have a little better information, but not great information, by the time we go to making allocations in a couple of months. So $50 million is still a reasonable number. And we did set aside, if you'll remember, and I haven't seen the final figures, but probably $8 million as a reserve in our first year's allocation. So we're okay using the $50 million, even if it comes in a little under, because we have the reserve to fall back.
And members, I would suggest that Bill consults with the Department of Finance before we make our final allocation, so that we have a firmer number, a more up-to-date number about what we can anticipate is going to be available in fiscal year 11. Again, remembering we do have that 10% cushion that we included in the first year's appropriation, but I think getting a more up-to-date and precise number would help us in making our final allocation. Questions of Dave on
the... we're spending money ahead anyhow, so the fact that we're 2% under of what will be collected this year, which we've already allocated. We're really talking about what will come in next year that we're going to be allocating. So it's we're in the ballpark, I guess, is where it's at. And I would guess that $50 million is a reasonable number for us to key in on. This is far in advance of the allocation, when the money would actually be spent.
And I'm assuming these quarterly reports are just that, that we'll have another quarterly report in mid-January. Great.
Sure, you're actually going to have another forecast. There'll be a November forecast. Mm-hmm. It could be early December, but you're not going to be getting an allocation until December. So it'll be certain that the forecast will be out there, and that will forecast the revenue for the next fiscal year 11. So you will have that when you're making your allocations. And I just wanted to note that the call for funding we put this, it could be five.
Oh, it did. Okay.
And we'll have to see what the forecast. Yeah. We'll have a forecast in hand. And that was just what you were guessing at the time.
If the economic recovery actually happens, 55 is a reasonable number. If you completely understand that, let me know.
Yes, Bill.
You said $8 million in reserve. Where was the balance that we set aside last time? Where does that stand? Is that a running thing we're going to be doing? If we dip into that and it gets down to $2 million, when do we decide to replenish that? How do we go about doing that?
Well,
any guidelines that
we estimated that we would have $70 million this year to spend, and then we allocated. The legislature allocated another, call it $20 million for the next fiscal year out of what's expected in 2011. So if you use the $70 million as a number that will be consistent, if we allocated $70 million, I'm just making sure I'm not saying something wrong. We allocated $52 million. That was what was in the bill, right?
No, it was higher than that.
No, it was 60.
It was 68. 68 million?
67. So we don't have a lot of that will carry forward whatever it comes in at the end of the year up to that 69,532,000. So we didn't really set aside that much of a reserve against the $70 million deal. I'm sorry.
Actually, I think the November forecast, last year's November forecast, estimated 77.5 million. One of the first things we did was the 10% reserve. Then the February forecast came.
That's where it is. Thank you, Rick.
A little bit more. So I think we have the 10% based on a rough 76, 77, and then the appropriation of 69. We will get these monthly, you know, so we can track it. But the key one will be the November forecast. That will give us the projection, and then the reality will be the February forecast.
But the reality is that by not spending everything we thought we had in November, we actually were really smart. Because February came in far worse. So the reserve has been somewhat eaten up by the virtue of the money not coming in.
On that point, Greg, just a real quick clarification. On next year, for fiscal year 11, you're going to have 12 months of sales tax collection. So you will have a little more money than the last time. The last time it was based on 11 months of collection, so you'll have 12 months, yeah. So it could be a little bit higher.
Because it's a minor.
I think your 55 million was a pretty good estimate of a reasonable level that you're going to have available. We'll just have to see when the rubber end work is.
Yeah, just a quick question. David, on our administrative costs, are we on track to be okay with that? Any feeling for how we're doing that?
I think it's the fact that we haven't had a lot of staff support is working to our advantage.
Okay.
But we're not spending anything we didn't think we were going to spend. And it was budgeted reasonably conservatively. So I would say at this point there's no huge surprises that I'm aware of. Bill, are you aware of any?
No, everything has been to the good.
Other questions of Dave? Again, I think the conversation the last 5 minutes speaks to the need to make sure we have a good estimate, which we'll get in November, of what that collection is projected in fiscal 11.
Both the projection in 10 and 11, so that we can see what our reserve is likely to be at the end of 10 going into 11, but we're allocating appropriately.
Okay, next item on the agenda is the Emerald Ash Borer Quarterly Status Report. Joe Martin from the Department of Agriculture is here to give us an update. Joe, do you have enough light there? Should we turn that? You're okay? Okay. Recall, members, that in this appropriation that the Department of Agriculture is to provide quarterly updates on the status of this, and I'm looking in the appropriation language for it, but I do recall it was in the rider language. So, welcome, Joel. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the council. Joe Martin with Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Agriculture. I have oversight over several of the regulatory units, but most apropos for this is the plant protection unit that's done a lot of work on Emerald Ash Borer. And I guess today, just going to give an overview, as you said, Mr. Chair, of the quarterly progress report, step you through that document. I do have two individuals with me today. If there's any specific questions related to the grants portion of the document, we have Bob Cook, and if there's any general questions just on overall operations in response to EAB, I have Mark Abramson here. So when looking at the document, basically how it's organized is page one is you have an overview of our incident response system, and then pages one through six takes you through the chronology of basically what we've done as a department and a state in responding to EAB. And it's broken out really in three areas. One is the Houston County response, the second is the St. Paul response, and then the third is just overall statewide response. On pages 7 and 8, you'll find a budget financial report, and this to our best trying to provide some transparency on the funding sources of the monies that we've used in terms of incident response to EAB. And that that gives an overview of the money that we received through USDA. The two units of USDA we interact with is the Forest Service and also APHIS PPQ. So that gives an overview of the dollars we received from the federal government in response. And then also our internal budget, what we spent, along with there is also a line that talks about the DNR's effort in this also. The meat of the report that you'll most likely are most interested in starts on page 8 and 9. This is gives an overview of the Forest Protection Reserve appropriation, the $2 million that was appropriated from sales tax revenue. This sort of breaks out into two areas, and I believe that you received an update the last time in terms of the grant process that we're going through. As of now, we have released the RFP. It was released on October 7th, and we have $1.875 million of the $2 million slated to go out in grants, and we've really tried to break this out into two efforts, because as we see it, there's two primary roles in terms of grant monies, and it comes back to local units of government being ready and able to respond to EAB when it arrives in their communities. So the first grant program is an incident response grant. That is for communities that have confirmed EAB and what they need to do to basically remediate the effects of that. The second grant program is a planning and preparedness grant, and that's for communities that can expect to find EAB soon, or basically any community that comes forward with some good ideas in terms of what they need to do to prepare to respond to EAB. The last portion of that appropriation is $125,000. The best way to look at that piece of the puzzle is going to be a technical assistance portion that's going to be used either through MDA or DNR or in cooperation in terms of basically outreach to local units of government to make sure that they have adopted operational guidelines in terms of knowing what to do logistically, because there's a lot of logistics that happen once EAB is found in the community, the steps that need to take place with quarantines and such. So backing up a little bit in the process of these grants, as I said, the RFP was released on October 7th. It'll close on November 20th. We have a review committee that will look through these proposals. The review committee will be comprised of the Department of Agriculture, DNR, USDA Forest Service, USDA APHIS, the Association of Counties, the League of Cities, and the Forest Resources Council. So I know there's a lot of, I've been receiving a lot of questions on what type of activities are we going to fund. We've laid out the RFP in some generalities. I can't tell you specifically what exactly we're going to fund. I think that's part of the RFP process, is as individuals send in their ideas, that'll be the review committee's responsibility to look through those and see what they think is appropriate. So our hope is to have the grant selected by December 15th and the grant executed by January 15th. I would just finish with the last part of the report on pages 10 through 12. You'll find the findings and recommendations section. I think this is an important one for folks to look over, because while there's been a lot of focus on the grants portion, I think we need to take a step back and really try to grasp what we're trying to do here. And it sort of breaks out into what is your response and what's the appropriate response in dealing with Emerald Ash Borer. Unfortunately, what we've learned is efforts to eradicate this beetle have been unsuccessful at best in other communities that have tried to go that route. So really, I think what the accepted approach to dealing with EAB nationally has been to slow the spread. And this is an effective strategy, because while, yes, EAB will spread throughout the state and the nation, we can do some things to knock back populations to provide ourselves more time to catch up in terms of diversification of our forests, especially in our urban areas. But also, there are efforts that we can do in terms of protecting our public forests. If we, anything that we can do to slow the spread, keep the populations down, we're going to be protecting our public forests, especially in the northern part of the state. So really, I think that's the part of this the puzzle that folks need to think about and sort of accept that that's the strategy that going forward from this point, this is what we're looking at. In terms of the recommendations, you'll find, I should say, this report's going to be finalized within days and delivered to the governor's office and also the appropriate legislative committee. So the recommendations, as you see, are pretty general, but we think that they're important. It talks about adopting the slow the spread strategy, local units of government being prepared to respond to EED once found in the community, adopting an integrated approach to dealing with pests, long-term diversification, and I think in the catch-all is just public awareness. You've seen a lot of efforts about not moving firewood. We're going to continue on that message because, as of now, that's the biggest risk factor of spreading EED throughout the state. So there's also a lot of appendix information I won't go through, but I guess I'll stop there if there's any questions. As I said, we do have some folks here that can give them more details to can answer them.
Thanks, Joel. Bob, start off with a question.
Yeah, I've heard there's a local arborist in Fairmont, surprisingly him. But he says there's not a cure for it, but there's a way that they stop it from happening, and they charge so much per inch of the tree. Have you heard any preventive thing? It's a long-term process. I think it's owned by...
I'll ask Mark Abramson to... address that. Up here. Mark has been basically our point person in terms of state operations with the EAB, and I believe the question you're asking is chemical treatments in terms of dealing with thermal dashboards. So maybe Mark, you can talk about that.
Yeah, that's correct.
Could you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure. Mark Abramson, an entomologist at the Department of Agriculture. It's true, there is a chemical treatment you can use for individual trees, and there's a few different products, a few different active ingredients in those products, and a variety of application types. And at this point, the research has shown that you can expect a pretty reasonable chance of success at protecting a tree using those chemicals. But the trade-off is that it's really something that is for an individual tree and is not something that is effective on the scale of a forest or something like that. So it is true that if someone has a high-value tree on their property, they could use a chemical to have a good chance of preserving that tree.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Bill?
Yes,
thanks, Mr. Chair. Is there any other state dollars going into this plan right now, if you know? Other than the funding that this group has given you, any other state funding for dealing with animal ash borer?
Mr. Chair, if you turn to page 8, you'll find that internally the department spent a little over $400,000 out of its existing budget in the EAB response.
So, Bill, a follow-up question. So, are you looking at more dollars for the up-and-coming year, or is that going to be the end of the line for the state dollars?
Mr. Chair, as you know, last year was the budget year. We plan on spending. This has been a yearly expense. We have budgeted and encumbered dollars for the following year, so I think you could expect another. Probably another around $400,000 of state internal of MBA budget being spent from EAB response also.
So just for clarification, the $400,000 is internal to the Department of Ag from its operating budget?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
The question I have is I'm looking at your budget. You had, just from APHIS alone, you had just under $800,000 beginning April 1, the appropriation for 1 year, and you indicate you spent $289,000. So, at least on a prorated basis, you certainly haven't expended that appropriation in equal amounts over the 12 months of the appropriation's life. And I know from the appropriate, from the rider language, that the money's available if the commissioner can certify that adequate funds are not available. Can you explain to me, and I suspect other council members, I guess I would have expected to see a real, a much stronger need for funding than what I'm seeing here, where you spent maybe a third of the budget over 6.5, 7 months. Help me understand that a little better.
Mr. Chair, the majority of those dollars are encumbered, but not spent. There's a lot of work that we plan to do in the future, but I guess they're also were bound by some restrictions of what the grants that was signed with USDA in terms of activities that were allowed. But we're looking at it in terms of those dollars for internal use. In the MDA, whereas the forest appropriation was a grant program to external parties.
So just to help me understand this appropriation from APHIS, wasn't the APHIS appropriation for disposal and testing of trees that were either infected or suspected to be infected of the Emerald Ash Borer?
Yeah, Mark Abrams. That was just a small portion of the grant was for retrieving samples from the original trees that were removed to get a date on when this infestation began. So if the sample is able to use a technique called dendrochronology, which uses the growth rings to figure out when the trees became infested. And that there was, I think, approximately 20,000 of that award that was specified for that work.
And so beyond that, what are the uses of that fund for?
The APHIS award we're using to fund the purple trap survey that we did this year. We're using it to fund regulatory efforts where we're working with businesses that work in the quarantines and individuals. And we're also using it to conduct outreach. So those are really the three components that in that award.
Yep. Just out of curiosity question. So when you find out when the trees were infested, what does that do to your plan?
What we found from that was that the earliest indication they have of trees becoming infested is 2006, which means that that's possible the year that it began. It's also possible it began in 2005, and we just didn't capture any sampling. But either way, we're looking at a 3 to 4 year old infestation, which is fairly early in terms of discovering an Emerald Ash Borer infestation. And what it tells us is that we've got a fairly good jump on dealing with this, and that we can concentrate our efforts on a fairly limited area, at least in terms of natural spread of the insect. The advice from USDA is to factor about a mile of natural spread for every year of infestation. So we're concentrating our efforts now on a 3 mile radius area around that original neighborhood in terms of most intense survey outreach and work with the cities, because that's our core area. And that's really the nuts and bolts of what it tells us. Typically, it's more like a 5 to 6 year delay in terms of these infestations being caught, so we were a little bit on the early side of the curve. And it's very helpful because what we know of EAB elsewhere is that as infestation grows older, the growth becomes much more rapid. And so the earlier you catch it in terms of the lifespan, the better chance you have of delaying that more rapid growth of the population.
You referenced in the beginning of this quarterly update the Minnesota Emerald Ash Borer Response Plan that was prepared a couple years ago in 2007. I went through the plan. Actually, I spent quite a bit of time reading it, and I thought it was a pretty good plan. But I'm having a real hard time trying to understand the difference between what's contained in this plan that I just mentioned, which is pretty comprehensive and talks about the roles of the different agencies from the local units of government through the Department of Agriculture and federal government, versus what you anticipate you're going to get in your response to your call for local planning. Help me understand what additional planning is going to happen. And I know, Joe, you made a comment earlier, you don't really know until you see what proposals come in. But help me understand, what are you looking for in the proposals for this part of the appropriation, and particularly how is it going to be distinct from this plan that I just referenced? Because I'm for the life of me, I'm trying to figure out what additional planning is going to have to happen.
Mr. Chair and members, personally, what I'm looking for is I think there's a lot of plans. I think there's a lot of plans on paper, but I don't see a lot of action in terms of adoption of the plans. So I think that's what we're going to be looking for in terms of RFPs that come in, is making sure that these response plans that have been developed over years, that there's actually adoption of them and action in terms of local communities adequately preparing for Emerald Ashport. No, Mark, if you have any questions to add there.
That's a good assessment.
I'm still not clear. Can you give me a little more specificity about what actually will be funded?
Bob, you want to try to address that? Bob Cook has worked extensively on the RFP in terms of what some expenditures of the communities would be, so I'd ask him to put some of that in.
Do you have any questions?
I'm Bob Cook. I'm another entomologist with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I brought with me today copies of the RFP. I thought maybe if I hand that out, it might help to show us some examples of what we're considering qualified versus unqualified expenses for the grant program. And to follow up on what Joe was saying, I think what we're really looking to fund is to start implementing these plans so that it will allow impacted communities some funds to start taking down the infested trees to lower the population levels in those infested areas, which will then in turn slow the rate of spread to uninfested areas. And in the uninfested areas, maybe providing funds for those communities to reduce the phloem area, the trees in which the beetles live and reproduce. There's some research from the infested state showing that if you can reduce the overall surface area of the phloem area in the forest, you can lessen the rate of population growth and then, in turn, slow the rate of spread.
So, help me understand the scale of this. In the next 20 years, how much money are you going to need to do what you want?
Mr. Chair, we haven't made any estimates.
No, give me something. You must have talked about the scale of this and what you think it's going to take, what the cities are going to request. I mean, this is coming. How much money are we talking about?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we haven't made any of those estimates. This is part of the process of beginning of dealing with EAB. We've heard over and over again about the lack of capacity at the local level. We're going to try to assess that the best we can of what local units of government are going to need to deal with EAB. We're beginning that process and dialogue to find that out.
Well, can't you extrapolate what St. Paul went through to get a number?
I think the key thing is what St. Paul has done so far has been just a small step along this whole way. I mean, this is a long-term problem, and I think, the important thing is to emphasizing that trying to delay the rate at which this is occurring, because if it, let's say, if you can postpone it for 20 years in terms of a widespread impact, then what it's going to take for cities to deal with this will be much smaller than if it happens right now and they're dealing with it in a big way over the next 10 years or something. So it's really hard to say which one of those scenarios is going to play out. The more time that cities have before they have a major impact, the more time they have that to reduce their ash resource and be better prepared for it.
Mr. Chair, I would add that in trying to ascertain what the budget or what the cost of EAB will be in the future, it really is scaled on what your strategy is. I mean, if we adopt a strategy of we should clear cut every tree within 2 miles of an EAB infestation and replant trees, then you're talking about a lot of money. Now, if you're talking about a strategy that a more methodical strategy of slowing the spread, trapping, it's probably going to be considerably less. But if the cost of dealing with EABs depends on the scale of the response.
Maybe I'm missing this, but it would seem to me that there's never going to be enough money to stop this debt. When it actually gets here, the cities, the state isn't going to have enough money to roll out and create a slow process. You know, what happened in St. Paul was one small area. If you got 20 of those, you'd have a huge issue going on, and the likelihood there'd be enough money found to completely deal with that is questionable, I think. So, you know, then you're into the damage control, and you know, money's got to be huge. You know, you got to be talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, aren't you?
Mr. Chair, I'd say that's a fair assessment.
Is there any talk of where all that money's going to come from?
Mr. Chair, I think there's discussions ongoing, and I'm sure it's going to be an issue that the legislature is going to take up in the coming years.
I want to go back, if I may. I'm still having a real hard time just trying to understand the distinction between this plan that was prepared by Ag in 2007 and what you're looking for in plan and prepare for the invasion of emerald ash borer. Just give me a little bit more detail about if a community was given $100,000, what would they use the money for, and particularly how that's distinct from the plan that I've referenced.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry that I can't provide any more details on it. I think what it goes back to is it takes people and resources within communities to do the work, whether it's some communities don't even know how many ash trees they have. So perhaps some of the activity may be doing a survey of all the ash trees in the area. It may be working internally with the city staff to be prepared and have a... When I say prepared, I think that, like I said before, there's many plans, but you know as well as I do that plans sitting on the shelf aren't very effective unless individuals know exactly what their roles are going to be. So some of it may be actually working directly with city employees or it could be some equipment they need. I wish I could provide more details, but honestly, right now, we are looking for the advice of the local units of government, and that's what all this process is about. Is over and over we've heard that local units of government need assistance. So this is the effort that we're trying to provide to them because we believe the locals have the best knowledge of what they need to do.
Ellen?
Oh, Mr. Chair, just 2 points I wanted to make. One is that apparently in 2006, the department asked for $20 million in bonding to remove diseased trees around the state, diseased shade trees, I assume urban trees. And that wasn't in the budget. It wasn't in the governor's budget, but that's just an example of something we may be seeing again.
But just to clarify, there's two RFPs. One is to do that. It's to remove diseased trees. That's... Mm-hmm. That's the
that's the incident response.
Right. And I was referring to the other one.
I'm just, Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of responding to David's more general comment about how much money is this going to take. And this was a request for all diseased trees. It wasn't just emerald ash borer. This was before the infestation was discovered. And so it's definitely something that is in the Department of Ag's purview over time. The other thing I just wanted to mention, and this doesn't go to your specific question, Mike, but in terms of the issue of buying time and the value of doing that, I just wanted members to know that the LCCMR has approved a research project for the black ash in the swamps of northern Minnesota to try to get us some information about how to, you know, what the impact will be and how we can protect those ecosystems. So that's another piece of the equation about trying to have a little bit of time to get some research done and some results that will help us try to contain the spread of this.
Sure. I think the larger question, there's really two models, or there's a couple other things that have happened already in the state, and that was the Dutch Elm response, which was a broad multi-agency response with local governments in the state in the 70s and 80s. But in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, we also have the Gypsy Moth response, which was then a state responsibility rather than a local unit of government. That state responsibility resides with ag, because it still is determined with Gypsy Moth that it hasn't been established. Once it, correct me if I'm wrong, once it becomes established, then it goes over to the Department of Natural Resources for management. So for Gypsy Moth, we've had a 20-25 year incident response, essentially trying to prevent it from becoming established in the state. And the state has done that. Those are general fund dollars, if I remember correctly. So I think what's happening here is that you're doing Gypsy Moth, you've got all the other menu of other insects or diseases that are going to come and continue to come. And the burden falls on local units of government. So St. Paul did the response. We were lucky that in the southeast that it didn't go into Houston County or Winona County, and then you'd have the other cities involved with it. The money that, correct me if I'm wrong, the money that was provided by APHIS was really surveillance and testing rather than incident response. Mr. Chair, primarily. So we have the incident response part, and the planning part is that if we have this established popping up all over the state, local units of government will be on the front line. They'll have to do it. And for them to be prepared, there's going to have to be somebody doing it. I'm not sure if the local units of government will apply, because they're going to be responding to other things. But I think you're going to see around the state people apply, local units will apply. I hope that they do it in collaboration, so it's not just a city. It's multiple cities, or it's a city and a county and townships, because really it's going to require coordination of this and other pests.
Wes, speaking as a farmer background, if you look at the natural spread, we're looking at this probably making it to the Alexandria area probably in 50 years, which probably is about the life cycle of that tree. And if you look at the Dutch elm problem, have we got any less Dutch elms in the state than we had 30 years ago? I doubt it. We look at the Dutch elm, the standing Dutch elm, as a nice wood source for firewood. And I think the two primary control methods are stopping the spread of the resource, the dead trees. And is there anything that's really going to be done to stop this in the long run? In 20 years, are we going to see any results from this other than using diversification of replanting?
Mr. Martin?
Mr. Chair, we don't have expertise in Dutch elm disease, but I'll ask Mark to talk a little bit about the spread of EAB and address some of your questions.
Yeah, I think we can make a huge difference in terms of the overall spread. If we look at Michigan as an example, they've done a good job of reconstructing what happened with Emerald Ash Borer. And what they found is that before 2002, when they discovered it, when nothing was being done in terms of trying to prohibit movement, remove diseased trees, et cetera, the spread rate was about 20 miles per year. When you factor everything together, moving wood, natural spread, basically any means that it can get around. And so if you looked at that in terms of Minnesota, 20 miles per year, within about 20 to 25 years, we're going to have Emerald Ash Borer everywhere in a big way in the state. Now, the estimate is that by implementing this work, we might be able to reduce that by about a factor of four. So we're looking at more of a spread rate of 3 to 4 miles per year when you factor, again, everything together, movement of wood, natural flight, all these things together. Now, that remains to be seen if that is really the case or not, but we will be able to be looking at that as we implement this program, and are we having an appreciable effect by implementing this or not.
Bob?
Just out of curiosity, my understanding that
commission has spent well over $100 million trying to take care of the farm. And I'm glad to hear that you're paying attention to what they have done, right and wrong. That should give us a pretty good look at what we can develop a pretty good proposal on. So I think if we're going to, I think that Michigan's kind of waving the white flag right now. And I hope we don't get to that point. But just like Les just said, it might not be that long run as we think it will be.
Scott?
The question I have is, and I think probably everyone would agree, that the number one thing you can do to slow the spread is to stop people from hauling firewood from one place in the continent to the other. How effective can you actually be on that? I was in a rest stop on 90 on the South Dakota border the other day, and there was two trailers full of firewood going somewhere. I mean, how do you monitor whether somebody's hauling that firewood in the back of a truck, 5 miles or 500 miles? How effective can we be in that?
I think the key point with firewood movement is that it has to be done through public outreach, and it's a message that's going to take time to get people to understand and accept how risky that can be, and it's not something that we're going to be able to regulate everybody who might haul a load of firewood, because there's lots of people and you can't sit at the border and wait for them to haul their wood through. But if you think about something like, aquatic plants and how it's just become kind of a common thing that people, you know, when they take their boat out of the water, they check their plants. And, you know, if someone takes their boat out of the water and then doesn't, then, you know, maybe someone would mention, hey, you should check your boat for plants. And I guess that's what I would hope is where we can get to with firewood, is that it becomes kind of a peer pressure type of thing where, you know, if you are going to bring wood to somewhere, someone else who you might be meeting that says, well, you really shouldn't bring that wood because you might be bringing something with it. So it becomes something that is just an accepted part of outdoor recreation, that it's not a good idea to do that. And I think it's not an easy, you know, there's a long history of moving firewood around, so it's not an easy fix, but I think that that's our best bet to try and slow this down as long as to keep putting that message out there and hoping to get some buy-in to it.
Darby?
Yeah, I'm looking at the planning and preparedness grant program, and I'm looking at qualified and unqualified expenses on page 2. And I see a number 9 that says qualified expenses would include tree treatments, systemic pesticide injections within 10 miles of trees documented to be infested and so forth. I've heard, and I may be wrong, and may not have been a credible source, but that those injections are expensive. And I'm wondering, so I get really scared when I see item number 9, and I'm wondering, can you elaborate, and what does it cost per tree, and is it reasonable to make that an expectation of a broad number of communities across the state?
For the price estimates, it depends on the chemical use and the application methods and the size of the tree. If it gets bigger, it requires more of the active ingredient. I've heard estimates of around $80 to $200 per tree, and that's on a yearly or every other year basis. And I don't think we would want the city to treat every single tree on their property. But what we would do maybe is allow some funding to treat some important trees or some subset of the trees in more of an integrated approach for preparing their community for the pest arrival, but not using the chemical treatments as a sole means of protection.
If that's the case, it might have been appropriate to add a little qualifying language on number 9, which made it more clear that this wasn't available kind of across the board.
Mr. Chair, can I just add that I think those are the type of questions that the review committee will grapple with to some extent, and the type of things that they may recommend to the commissioner. That if it's just a proposal just for all treatment, then I'm guessing that wouldn't be too highly opposed.
Scott?
No question.
Any other questions? You're none. Thank you. Thanks for the update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next item on the agenda is Lasard Sam's Conservation Partners Grant Program, and we're going to start this conversation with the Minnesota Native Seed Growers. And if you look on your agenda, there are four individuals who have asked to provide some comments. I would ask that the four individuals come down at once. Yeah, and we will let you determine the order of your presentation. And then following this conversation, we will have an update by the Department of Natural Resources on where they are with the program. So if you can find enough chairs to sit around the table or do musical chairs, it's your call. And welcome, and good morning. And if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bruce Clay, and I work for the Northern Seed Trade Association. I have to start. I hadn't planned to talk today. I came in my jeans, and what we have to do is some housekeeping here on your packet. Page 2 of your handout from these guys needs to be recalled. It's an inaccurate portrayal, and I consulted with Representative Hansen, who was a member of the conference committee.
Just before we go on, can you? We're all moving a little slow this morning, at least myself. So which
part is the one with the cost comparison?
What does the cover look like?
The cover starts as having cost comparison. The page in question is the one that says this is a synopsis.
Yep. It's an inaccurate synopsis. And I would like to recall that page. I was out of town for MEA. I did not review this material. And that page is inaccurate and does not belong in the packet. And Representative Hansen was a member of that conference, so Senator Engelbert, and I had a chance to talk to Representative Hansen. That is inaccurate, and I would like to recall that.
So one more time, it's the packet that on the front page, the lead title is Cost Comparison of Seed Mixtures Using Minnesota Statutes 84.02 and NRCS Standards. And the page in question is the second page in. The heading is, this is a synopsis of the effort in 2009 to repeal Minnesota Statute Section 84.02.
Mr. Chairman, members of the legislature, Mr. Knopf, folks that work with me, I've worked here 15 years, they know I operate ethically, and this page should not be in your packet.
Okay, Mr. Chair, anything else that needs to be excised from the pack?
If I could take those, I have a shredder at my office, and I'd like to take those with me if I could.
Rick, did you have a question on that point?
What was it on the table, or was it just to us?
Bill, do you know if there were handouts that were provided to members on this?
The handouts were not.
Not provided to members?
Just members of the audience?
Yes. Just to the table.
Just to the table. And Les, Mr. Chair, I forget your name.
Bruce Clay.
Bruce, what is inaccurate about it?
The primary inaccuracy is in the last paragraph. That's not what happened. The last paragraph is the main inaccuracy. The stuff about the introduction on page 1, that is accurate. But the way the conference committee went is not. And that's my concern.
Yeah, who produced this?
I had client communication way back in May with our members. So memories are a little shaky, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And Rick, any others? Mr. Chair, just whenever in the House, I think it's the same thing in the Senate. Whenever we provide something to the floor of the House, the member has to sign it. Or there's some identifier as to who produced a document. I think that would be a good thing. Just whenever we get documents, particularly if they come in the packet, that we have in the future some idea of who produced it. Because like the ag one, you know, we know it came from ag.
Yeah. So on this point, who should I write on the front of my document? Who prepared this?
The guys addressing it should be us.
What organization?
Northern Seed Trade Association.
Okay. And if the individuals who prepared this document, if they could provide Bill not only just their organization and contact for the organization, but also individually, that would be helpful. So in case we have follow-up, we know who to go to get information.
Sure.
Okay. Any other questions?
Me, about this material that was yanked at the afternoon, otherwise we can just discard that and move on.
I think we're ready to move on.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. Thank you to members of OSI, Sam, South, our Heritage Council, for allowing us to be here today. My name is Bill Olson. Along with my son, Jason, we own and operate Federal Prairie Seed Company in Newark, Minnesota. We grow locally cultivated grass and fork seeds in southern Minnesota. We employ approximately 3 full-time and up to 10 seasonal employees. With me today is Garth Casting, owner of Casting Seed Company in Fertile, Minnesota. Mike Ratzloff, the owner of Carlson Prairie Seed Company in Lake Bronson, Minnesota, both producers of native seed. And Mary Mueller, vice president of Wildlife Habitat Conservation Society of McCullough County and a former installer of prairie and grassland for state-funded programs. The job the council has been given by the people of Minnesota is a large one. I do not envy your task. As native seed producers and small business owners in Minnesota, we ask for this opportunity to address you as you start the next round of project selection so you might keep our concerns in mind as you go forward. Garth, Mike, and Mary will discuss the material they handed out, and then we would take questions from the committee. Garth will give you an overview of who the industry is and where the industry is at. So,
thank you, Bill. I think as requested, I'll indicate the handout that I prepared. It's the one that has Minnesota Native Wildflower and Grass Producers Guide. That's the handout I'm going to be referring to. I have business cards, so I'll pass them around.
And just, again, if you could, so what organization should I write across the face of this first page? Who is the author of this handout?
The author of this handout is myself.
Yes, and you are on behalf of yourself individually, or?
Well, there's two organizations, and I'll reference that in my opening statement. The Minnesota Native Wildflower and Grass Producers Association, the Northern Seed Trade Association, and then obviously myself. I'm a stakeholder in this issue too. And I'll just hand these out so you can have an identification. As Bill indicated, I think we'll all make just brief opening statements, and then we're very happy to answer any questions that you might have. And again, thank you for allowing us to appear today. I realize the council has numerous issues to discuss, so we appreciate your time very much. And as indicated, my name is Garth Casty, and along with my wife and father, I am the owner of Casty Seed Incorporated, which is a 2,800-acre seed production farm located in Polk County near Fertile, Minnesota. A vast majority of the acres we farm are devoted to native grass and forage seed production. My father started with 30 acres of production in 1983, and since then, we have seen a steady increase in the use of native seeds and plants in Minnesota and surrounding states. In order to respond to this interest and demand, a new Minnesota industry has developed. In my handout, I have included a listing of members of two organizations, and that's as indicated, the Native Grass and Wildflower Producers Association and the Northern Seed Trade Association. And these represent the interest of this industry and list some of the individual companies that supply seed and services to the prairie restoration industry in Minnesota. A majority of these are family-run enterprises that provide jobs and pay taxes in the state. We are not Big Ag, as labeled by one House member during the recent legislative session. I do not even know what Big Ag means, but I do know that without public-private partnerships between the native seed industry and state agencies, conservation efforts will suffer. One example of a partnership is included in your handout. That'd be page 3. This is a Board of Water and Soil Resources fact sheet which outlines the successes of the Minnesota River CREP program. The CREP program restored 100,000 acres of wildlife habitat, which has improved water quality and reduced pollution in the Minnesota River Basin. How were the 100,000 acres of wildlife habitat restored? The prairies were restored by utilizing the seed and services of Minnesota's native seed industry. Landowners were able to access adapted native plant materials to seed diverse stands of native grasses and forbs at a reasonable cost. Paragraph 2 in the handout says it best on that voucher fact sheet. PREP was a golden opportunity to make sure that taxpayer dollars were put to use in solutions rather than studies that will result in a cleaner Minnesota river. One of the main points we're trying to make today is that the native seed industry currently has plentiful stocks of highly adapted native plant materials for the LASARD SAMS programs. By utilizing these stocks, Minnesotans can achieve unprecedented conservation successes. However, if the current highly restrictive specifications are forced upon these efforts, the result will be less, and I emphasize, less conservation on Minnesota's landscape. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, please, introduce yourself.
Members, or Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Mike Grasloff. My wife and I own a company called Carlson Prairie Seed Farm. And we'll show up on your list there. I'm responsible for the pack. So we have the removal of the document. I provided this pack of information that you're looking at. It was my mistake. I apologize for the hassle here. My wife and I own a company, Carlson Prairie Seed Farm, Inc. We're located in Kitson County, Minnesota. We produce, process, package, and market native seed. We've been in business for 10 years. You could add another 10 years to our business for our predecessor. My background is in farming and a degree at NDSU in soil science. I worked for 13 years with the Natural Resource Conservation Service throughout the state. I helped enroll and provided guidance on well over 200,000 acres of CRP as it has been enrolled in Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the native seed guidelines that have been put out for the LASARD monies for the small grants program. Basically, I'm here to discuss those guidelines and talk about how we've got to the point that we are. As a matter of providing some background information, that's why I put this pack together for you. There's about 10 pages in there. I only intend on referencing the top page with the budget on it. The rest of it is simply information that I feel is very important for the members of this council to have in your hands as you review seeding guidelines for these programs. It shows the effort that we've been putting in the last 2 or 3 years at the legislative level and the LCCMR committee to deal with this native seed guideline issue, specifically Minnesota Statute 84.02. That statute is not in your guidelines. However, if you take the information out of those guidelines, it clearly is directly influenced by that statute. Our industry has been providing native seed to the state and federal conservation programs for more than 2 decades. We hope that the excellent relationship that has been established between growers, seed vendors, and land managers implementing the programs can continue to produce the excellent results for the environment and the development of prairie habitat. We have great successes in this state. This program, the seed industry, and the partnership with DNR and Bowser and many different state agencies, county agencies, has been very successful for many decades in this state. I don't think there's anything to be embarrassed about for what we've done so far. Today, I have 2 topics. One is the relationship between the public agency and the private sector in the prairie restoration world and how some of the current specs, the guidelines that are coming from the LASARD Council, may impact the implementation of some of these habitat projects. And the second I'll address is the cost associated with these new requirements. The growers represented here today, Bill, Garth, and myself, I consider rare product producers. We have we've been working diligently for many years to produce native species that were before unavailable. Includes plant material releases from the USDA, native selections that we make on our own, walking out and just hand picking and starting a process like that. Many of them would not be commercially available if this group of dedicated growers had not put their blood, sweat, and tears into their development. The state of Minnesota has been a partner with this industry since the beginning, and both sides have benefited. Growers have benefited by being able to run a business, to support themselves, and also employ hundreds of people in the state that that it requires to get the seed in the bag. The state benefited by having access to native species that were unavailable before, and they've been able to restore thousands of acres of prairie in the state with that seed. Land managers at the level of the project implementation, those are the folks that I end up dealing with. They've been making the decisions on seed source for many years, and they've had great success doing it. Having restrictions in place that limit these experts' ability to make decisions at the site of restoration does not seem like the right direction from my point of view. In fact, I believe the current set of guidelines, albeit they are a great improvement from where we started 2 or 3 years ago, I still believe these guidelines will result in less work being done because of the high cost that is associated with these guidelines. Plant Material Centers is a division of the USDA. They've been working in the business of native seed and vegetative materials for about 70 years. The USDA, the Plant Material Center, they developed guidelines for movement of seed. They were established by watching native plant performance and fitness over a long period of time. They recognized that they wanted seed growers and businesses that could be supported and have the ability to supply the need of conservation in seed. A reasonable geographic area has to be available to have a market. The guidelines that have been in place for decades are moving of the seed 200 miles north or south, 300 miles east or west. Those are the guidelines. The framework has been used for decades. It has produced successful plantings we have today.
Can I just interrupt? Excuse me. Whose guidelines are these that you're talking about, these longstanding guidelines?
Plant Material Center is a branch of the Natural Resource Conservation Service.
So these are federal guidelines that have been established?
Yes.
Okay, and these are regionally based? In other words, the guidelines in Minnesota might be different than the ones in California?
No, to my knowledge, it would be a nationwide guideline. I don't have any knowledge of it being different. I could be wrong, but
thank you.
There are 6 or 7 of these stations. One of them is in Bismarck. One of them is in Missouri. There are 6 or 7 of them scattered around the U.S.
Excuse me. I think there is, they are regionally based because we have there's a location in Bismarck, North Dakota, and there's a plant materials specialist that represents Minnesota. So he would define, and they are for Minnesota specifications are developed right down at the by state biologists for Minnesota NRCS.
They are regional. Yes, if I misunderstood your question. Over the last 2 or 3 years in the state, having this set of guidelines such as this, they stay consistent. They have been consistent for decades. That allows businesses such as ourselves and the other folks in this audience behind me, it allows us to develop products that we realize there is a market for. Over the last 2 or 3 years in the state of Minnesota, we've watched these native seed guidelines continuously changing. It does not allow a business to prepare to provide the things that the state is asking for because the target is continuously moving. That's all I'd like to say about that. Basically, the relationship between the state agencies and the native seed industry has been excellent for many years, and I hope that can continue. The second thing I'd like to talk about is the budget. If you look at your handout, the top page, it's a cost comparison, and this was developed for a different presentation, so it's referencing in the statute 84.02, but I think it pertains here, and you can read that. You can see obviously there's a significant cost increase by putting the restrictions on seed movement, and the one example is actually with local ecotype in the center of your page there. That would be very comparable to the guidelines that we're working with the LASAR grant program. So there's a significant increase in cost of these restrictions. Basically, it just tells me that there has to be a limited amount of money, and the more cost, the less that can get done, is my point with that budget.
I know Ellen has a question. Can you just help me understand with these three comparisons, how far out for the NRCS standard you're saying 200 miles? Is that correct?
Yes. On the bottom there, I reckon that standard for NRCS that we work in this region is 200 miles north and south for movement of the seed and 300 miles east and west.
Ellen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we need a little clarity here before we delve into these numbers. I'm trying to remember what happened at, about half an hour before the Senate, before the legislature adjourned last session. I was not on the Environment Policy Conference Committee, but we had extensive debate about these standards in our policy committees over in both the House and Senate over the whole session. And we reached some compromise language that said there needs to be native ecotypes, but it had some sort of flexibility in it that said wherever possible, and it had to be native to the region, and I don't have it in front of me.
I do.
Okay.
You want me to read it?
Well, but let me finish my question, and then, yes, I would like you to read it, because then there's the old law, that's 8402, that said it had to be, you know, native ecotype meant within 25 miles or the same county or something like that. And we're referring to both of those. In the end, did you go back to the 25 miles? I can't remember what happened in the conference committee, because we had this compromise language that everybody agreed was reasonable, that Bowser supported, and we put that's in the Lessard family. Law at this point. Greg,
tell
me. I can't remember what happened.
Chair Dillon, Greg. 84.2 is still in existence. That was not repealed or not modified in any extent.
Oh.
But it doesn't necessarily apply to programs unless you make it apply to programs.
Mm-hmm.
So this program, that statute does not apply to this program because it was not made to apply to this program.
So, Mr. Chair, so the 84, the part about the 25 miles is still in law.
Still in law. But
because we had hoped to replace that with this compromise language. That didn't happen in the conference committee, I think.
84.2
was not. It was not amended at all. I know it, and so, okay, but that only applies where it's referenced, and so it would only apply to probably, I don't know,
yeah.
I mean.
Mr. Chair, it says it applies to Chapter 84, and that's it. So it applies to Chapter 84 unless you make it apply somewhere else. You would have to reference it as part of the appropriation to make it apply to this program.
So in common terms, Greg, what projects would 84 requirement apply to? You mean for wildlife management areas?
No, Mr. Chair, those are in Chapter 97A.
So what would it apply to then?
Well, that's only places where that term is used in Chapter 84, which isn't very often.
Does it, Mr. Chair, when we talk about native prairie or remnant prairie, does it apply then? Because I know 8402 references that.
But, Mr. Chair,
no.
It only applies to Chapter 84 the way it's written. What happened is, I think a couple of years ago, the bonding bill contained language that cross-referenced 84.02, and that's how it got into the bonding language. Was because of a reference, but it doesn't apply to anything else unless it's a program in Chapter 84. But most of the programs that you're dealing with aren't in Chapter 84.
So, and Mr. Chair, I know that in legislation last year we put this compromise language in place in the bonding bill. We put it in the clean water in all the legacy programs, and I think we did something else with Bowser with it, with funding. I mean, we sprinkled it throughout the statute books in a lot of places.
What?
So I think it's the predominant.
Mr. Chair, not our statute, just in the laws for last year, the appropriation laws for last year.
So they only apply to this biennium?
This biennium. Right?
Okay. And so one last question, Mr. Chair, is when folks are testifying, I need to know which standard they're complaining about, whether it's the 25-mile requirement that's in 8402 or the other language that I consider the compromise language that we passed. Are we put into appropriations bill last session?
Both. Mr. Chair.
So just to clarify, members, from Chapter 172, which is the bill that contained our appropriations that we recommended last year, for the project requirements, now we're not talking about the small grants program, but we're talking about all the others' projects. Well, we have separate language that relates specifically to the small grants program. That's in your handout that Bill provided.
Mr. Chair, I think the language is the same for this part.
Mr. Chair, there's one slight difference in where a phrase is located.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, you're right. Technically, it's different. The intent is the same. But basically it says plant vegetation or sow seed only of ecotypes native to Minnesota and preferably of the local ecotype, using a high diversity of species originating from as close to the restoration site as possible and protecting existing native prairies from genetic contamination to the extent possible if conducting prairie restorations is a component of the accomplishment plan. I think that's what you were referring to.
Yes, and so Mr. Chair, I consider that to be quite flexible language. It doesn't have a mile, it doesn't reference 200 miles, 25 miles. It says as close as possible, but it expresses the very strong standard that we want to protect. We want as local as possible, and we want to protect genetic diversity. So I'm wondering, what I don't understand is whether the testifiers are what, when you talk about these dollar amounts, which standard are you referencing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, when I started speaking about that, I made the comment that it is in reference to the statute. Those numbers were prepared for 84.02. In the middle of your page, there's a category for C called local ecotype. My footnote says the local ecotype would be very similar to the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program guidelines. There's two specific things on this page. One is 84.02. I'm telling you that local ecotype is very similar to Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program Local Ecotype Vegetation and Seed Guidelines dated October 9th, 2009. I'm trying to demonstrate that these guidelines cost extra money for the seed.
So I think members and Mr. Mueller and others, I think the point of clarification is which part of either statute or session laws this program falls under. And my interpretation is that the session laws dictate which language regarding local seed type applies. And my read of it is it isn't related to Chapter 84. But help me out, Greg. Is that, and Janelle, is that a correct interpretation? I think this is the crux of the argument, is whether or not Chapter 84, which says 25 miles, applies to the small grants program as well as any other appropriation from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in fiscal 2010-11. Help me out.
Well, Mr. Chair,
it would not apply.
02 does not apply to the program.
So let me ask as a follow-up to you and Janelle both. To the extent possible, I read that as being very permissive. But is it not permissive? Are there some tests for that? I mean, is that, to what extent can you not follow this part of the appropriation language?
Well, Mr. Chair, to the extent possible, would mean if it's available. So there is an availability issue when you use the term to the extent possible. That means, in other words, can I get it? It doesn't get at the whole cost issue. But it does say, But that part only applies to of ecotypes native to Minnesota. So that really just says you have to get ecotypes that are native to Minnesota. Whether they were raised or grown in Minnesota doesn't really matter at this point. It's just whether it's an ecotype that's native to Minnesota. And then it goes on to say, and preferably of a local ecotype. Now that's a preference, but it's not mandatory.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, and this is exactly what's problematic, I think, for the agency folks trying to write specifications and for the growers and the industry, is the ambiguity in language like this and that's part of the point we're making, is I don't know that it's causing so much confusion and debate, and what is to the extent possible, what does that mean? Does that mean we're willing to spend $5,000 an acre, the taxpayers are, and they could do it for $150 an acre? So does that mean to the extent possible? I mean, it's available. Maybe it's available, but it's 20 times the cost. I mean, we're just trying to understand what it's just added so much ambiguity for the people in the agencies trying to write specifications and for the growth.
Scott, I had you earlier. Did you?
I think the question on 8402 has been answered.
Yeah.
I mean, it applies only when it is directed, I mean, it's mentioned and directly applied to a project. Otherwise, 8402 does not apply. The difference between the NRCS standard and what might be a local ecotype comes down to a cost question. Is my understanding clear?
I think that's right. I know Ellen and Wes have questions. Help me understand: is the issue of ecotypes native to Minnesota, is that part of the issue? Because that's really, as Greg pointed out, the real constrained is that, you know, even though there's some flexibility, the session laws say that they need to be of equal tapes native to Minnesota. Are you getting seed that would be from equal tapes not native to Minnesota? Is that, in other words, it could be in South Dakota, but if it's an equal type that's native to McLeod County, I read this as saying that's fine. And so I'm just trying to understand, is that the issue, or?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't include in my packet, this is actually a document from the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program, Vegetation and Seed Update. I don't know if you folks have this available to you.
I don't believe we do.
I have it.
Okay, we'll be getting that here in just a bit.
I apologize, I just assumed that it was here because it's generated from the council. This document, these are the guidelines that have been put out for the small grants program for the seed sources. So they do not reference statute 84.02. However, if you go to the bottom of the page, there's a list of 10 things that are required for this program.
Let's hold off and just wait till everyone gets a copy. This is not our document, so...
I'm sorry.
Let's just give members a minute to digest it, and then if you want to walk through it and then point out your concerns related to...
I apologize.
So, members, this, I'm assuming, is the Department of Natural Resources document. And again, we need to have attribution somewhere in any one of these documents of where it comes from. So, members, if you would write, this is the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Conservation Partners Grant Program document. Okay, Mr. Mueller, I think we've got it now in front of us. And if you could point to those sections now of their requirements that are of concern.
Mr. Chairman, you keep referring to me to Mr. Mueller. Mrs. Mueller is behind me. I'm Mr. Rasloff. Sorry, I
don't want to be Mr. Mueller. My apologies, Mr. Rasloff. Please continue.
Apparently, I misunderstood the awareness of this board in this issue. What I was trying to show, this document is what I received for guidelines to provide seed for this grant program. I assume that it had come from the council. I apologize for that. It apparently has not. Right at the very top is the section that you read earlier. That is the section that gives us the flexibility, as Senator Anderson said, and that's that there is flexibility. Mm-hmm. Yes. Then, at the bottom, the 10 requirements have been plugged in. There, you start talking about the mile limits, number of species per mix. That goes above and beyond the legislation that I can read. It takes the flexibility out again. That is my concern.
Great. Thank you. Now it's at least clear to me the context for your concern. Now, members, we're going to have the Department of Natural Resources and representative of the Board of Water and Soil Resources up here shortly to provide some comment on not only this part but an update. But before Mr. Rasloff leaves the table, question for Mr. Rasloff. And Les, you've had your hand up for a while.
Statements, Chair, Mr. Rasloff. I think the confusion in 84.02 is we're confusing genetic selection with genetic modification. There is no genetic modification in native seed harvesting, as you people are aware of. And I don't think it would be practiced if it was available. There is one case that the University of Minnesota has just completed. It's the Blue Haven, which is the genetic selection of the little blue stem. It was found down in Lake Denton, Minnesota. It's now the present grass that's planted around the new Gopher Stadium in Minneapolis. And according to 84.02, we probably wouldn't be able to use that University of Minnesota genetic selection variety if we went according to 84.02. Working with you guys over the past 25 years, we've all learned a lot. And I think you guys are doing a fabulous job as far as providing us with a good product. We personally restored over 1,000 acres. We've got some problems in it that we've got to look at that are unrelated to genetic or selection problems. Types are some of the problems. But I think if we look at the basic requirements of genetic selection is a recognized normal agricultural process that we want to go through to be able to get the best seed varieties available and reproduction. And the Blue Haven is a good example of that. It was developed by Professor Mary Meyer of the University of Minnesota, and I talked to her quite extensively, and she could see no absolute justification in anything relating to a 25-mile radius restriction.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Caspi or Mr. Ratzbach? Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, Ellen.
Thank you. I think we're honing in on the issue here, which is how the DNR has interpreted the legislative language. It's what you're focused on. But I just want to get a little bit more, and Mike, you asked a similar question, I guess, but what is the very specific piece of these guidelines that creates the problem? Is it 150 miles? Or is it that the seeds have to be from the same eco region? What is it that adds the cost?
Both of those would certainly add to the cost.
And do you think that if you're going further than, it says if you can use seed from an adjoining state as long as the ecotype conditions in the adjoining state are similar, do you follow that criteria, that the ecotype conditions for seed that you use have to be similar to the project location?
I don't know if I understand the question. Okay, meaning that well, in geographic boundaries are, the political boundaries are inherently, aren't logical, in that you've got a project 30 miles east of the Red River in the Red River Valley, and there's seed from North Dakota. So that's, obviously the conditions are very similar. There's absolutely nothing wrong with using materials from North Dakota in western Minnesota. We've done it for years.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that this allows for that. But it said as long as the ecotype conditions are similar to the project location. That's what I'm looking at in number five.
And I think now that I think you mentioned it, I think you're referring to adaptability and making sure that you are aware that native plants are sensitive to movement over long distances. Mm-hmm. And we've known that for 75 years or whenever the research first started on recognizing that we do have native plants that we should utilize in this country. And I think, we know that. I think they're photosensitive, they're sensitive to winter kale, those types of things. So adaptability has been, extensively studied, and separate from, 25 miles has never been an issue as far as adaptability. They're adapted over much, much broader mileage range than that.
But we're not, Mr. Chair, I think we're really talking about the 25 miles.
No, okay.
That's off the table.
Okay, yeah, sorry. But even the 150, there's testing, lots of testing the USDA has done to prove that they're adapted over a much broader area than the 150 miles.
Bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is that exactly why the NRCS has come up with the mile parameters that they, through 200 miles north and south, and 300 miles east and west, is that why they come up with those standards? And is that group?
I think the reason they have those, if what they say is that if the item isn't adequately tested outside of those ranges, so you know that something is adapted, something from western North Dakota, maybe 350 miles, but you test it, and they put it through rigorous testing, and they know that it's adapted to the same conditions. If not, then you need to use those kind of mileage guidelines to ensure that it is adapted.
It's fair to say that you certainly agree with those standards, the NRCS.
Oh, that's how the Minnesota Rivercraft Program got done. Okay. Utilizing them.
And one more question. Would you be having a problem with the bottom, I guess, three sentences on the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program? Because 150 miles is recommended as a maximum distance. Now, that maximum distance word is probably going to stop a lot of projects from coming forward. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
It's kind of scary, kind of a little bit.
You can't, Mr. Chairman, it's very difficult to put that line on land. And when I say 200 north and south, east, north and south, 300 east and west, the guidelines, pure guidelines, they don't have a hard set, fast
You have to stop right here. You can't just, it's impossible to put that mileage guideline. And to further that, where did the 150 miles come from? Right. It's more than one mile. Well, 100 to 300 is something that's been studied for 70 years. Where is the 150?
So, Mr. Ratzlaff, what we will do then, after hearing your comments and questions from council members, we will ask the Department of Natural Resources to come up and explain those particular aspects. But we do have a couple other members who have questions, I believe, for you. So, in order, Dave.
Mr. Chair, so just excuse me for 1 second, but we do have one other member that traveled.
I understand that. Yep. Yep. David?
I will admit to being somewhat confused. It would be incredibly helpful to me, and I suspect some others, if you could come back with what you would, as an association or as a group, recommend we put in place replacing these 10 points that are driving you crazy, so that we can see what it is that you're willing as an industry to give us as standards, instead of us trying to interpret what's wrong with this and what's right with the NRCS stuff and what we're supposed to do. We're not experts at this.
I think, Mr. Chairman, and I stumbled here today because I didn't have time to prepare. I should have been more ready for this. But the gist of it is NRCS standard is very acceptable. It's been in place for decades. We've been operating under it. It's allowed businesses to function and the projects to be completed in this state.
So provide us what it is that would be acceptable in this other than just use NRCS standard. Because none of us know that. We haven't seen that before.
There's a link on page 2, Mr. Chairman, to NRCS practice standard 643. And click on that link. Obviously, you can't click on the link on the paper, but that would be where that is located. That has seat guidelines in it.
And again, it bears repeating, these guidelines were not developed by the council.
Sure.
The language that you cited at the top was what was in the appropriations bill that included the Outdoor Heritage Fund. The Department of Natural Resources has developed this, and we will hear from them in a bit. But the concerns, I appreciate your comments, because as we go to develop next year's appropriations recommendations, we are going to have, I suspect, native prairie restoration work, and we need to understand a model that works. So that your comments are helpful in that regard. But specific to this document, those comments and concerns do need to be directed to the Department of Natural Resources, since they're the author of this. I have Scott, and then Ellen, and then Darby. Scott.
Bill's question answered my question.
Okay. Ellen?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm having trouble understanding why 150 miles is too rigid and 200 miles is perfect. To me, if you're talking about a certain number of miles, you're being too arbitrary either way. It seems to me in some cases 200 miles maybe wouldn't be broad enough to encompass an ecoregion. And in some cases, it would be too broad. I mean, it depends. It depends on where you are. If you're near the edge of a change in the ecosystem, I don't know. So it seems to me that that's maybe one factor that you should look at, but not the only factor. And so I suspect that's what we're trying to get at here in this language. And so I'm not sure that just saying we want to have the 200, 300-mile standard solves the problem. I guess I want to know how we make sure that we're really focusing on being close, if possible, and having the right conditions that are very similar to where you're trying to restore. And so I appreciate what Dave said, that we would take your suggestions about how to sort of modify this, and we'll hear what the DNR says about how they came up with that. But I don't think that having an arbitrary mile amount is any better just because it's your mile amount versus the DNR's mile amount or Team Wagenius's. I mean, they're all arbitrary, and that's not how nature works.
And in fact, Senator Anderson, you very accurately summarized our conversation as a council last February or January, March, when we were developing this appropriations language. Was I remember this discussion about distance and whether we want to set it in stone. And as you can see from the top of your page, which was our recommendation, we decided against that for those reasons. Darby.
Really just a quick comment. What's really been missing all morning long is the discussion of the underlying science. And that disturbs me a lot because we have built our reputation around sound conservation science. And when I hear a comment about the high cost means less conservation on Minnesota landscapes, that may very well be true. But if we end up with seed coming from quite a distance away that is does not have the adaptability, does risk the potential of genomic swapping because of these distance sources, we don't gain any. I think we lose conservation outcomes as well. So it's really it's a complicated, knotty issue that we're dealing with, as you've indicated. And there pretty clearly there are a number of credible scientists who say there's a risk. Get as close to that. Get seed as close to that place you're going to plant it as possible because there are these other risks in terms of effectiveness of the establishment of the tree.
Jim?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is this the Conservation Partners legacy, is this the only thing you have a problem with, the language used on our everyday projects? You have no issues with that?
In other words, the language at the top of your handout that just cites the language in the appropriations bill about to the extent possible.
Other than that, to me, it's ambiguous. You know, I think what's everybody in a situation. What I've seen then is people go back to 8402 at that point.
Jim?
One other question. I like David's idea of you coming back to us with your suggestions, but it'd also be interesting, I don't know if this is possible, to put some associated cost with all these different parameters. The number of seeds in the mix, the distance, all these things. It would just be kind of interesting to know how this magnifies the cost of doing business, if that's possible.
Rick?
Harvey said that.
I referenced incorrectly many times Ms. Mueller, and I guess I'd like to have give her an opportunity to speak before the council if she chooses.
Mr. Chair, can I say one more thing to address the question that Darby, I believe it was?
Sure.
Asked about size.
Yeah, Mr. Rasloff, please.
In the packet that I handed out, there's a letter from the head of the plant genetics department at the University of Minnesota that will address the question very clearly. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning, Mary.
For the record, I'm Mary Mueller, and I'm here today from a little different perspective, and I'm representing the Wildlife Habitat Conservation Society of McLeod County, where I serve as Vice President and Habitat Coordinator. And the handout that I have is one with pictures in the front. And also for the record, this is the only handout I saw before I came to today. First of all, I want to say thanks for the opportunity to speak. And also thanks for all the hard work that you are all doing. I know this has been a real call to service, and I appreciate it, and I hope you're proud of the work you've been doing, because I've been watching, and I'm very proud of the work you've been doing. I was asked to talk about a little bit about how projects from small conservation clubs get on the land, and that's my just what I wanted to speak about today. If you go to pass the pictures into the third page of this project, the club that I represent today, Wildlife Habitat Conservation Society, we organized in 1988. And our goal was to develop some wildlife habitat within our county. A lot of the board members were members of many different conservation clubs. And we all made a little bit of money, but it was never enough to pull together big projects. and so we decided to organize in a little different form. And since that time, we have purchased about 26 parcels of land, totaling a little over 2,000 acres. And most of that land was an agricultural crop production prior to our purchasing the land. And what we've done is we've taken it a step further, typically, and we've restored those properties before we transfer them to a public agency for public enjoyment. And that's always been the end goal, is to have those lands open for public use. And I used to own a restoration company, a small local restoration company. So as a person with that expertise, I was the volunteer person who pulled these projects together. I decided to put together a list of the partners that we worked with. I thought it would be interesting to see that it is a partnership, the way we've been able to do our work, is a partnership between public, private, and nonprofits. And many have had a part to play. And I started out with a list of different conservation clubs that we meet annually, and sometimes if there's issues more often, to talk about projects and to raise funds. And there's a list of private companies that also are part of our partnership, and many times these companies offer products at a much reduced cost. We utilize local farmers to do much of our work, and rent equipment. We buy native tree stocks from the nurseries and native grasses from the private seed companies, and that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit as well. We also work closely with the state, federal, and local conservation agencies like the Department of Natural Resources, the Fish and Wildlife Service, NRCS, the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and I'm proud to say at the end of the list, I added Lasard Sam Outdoor Heritage Council, because we are the local sponsor of two farms that were accepted under the Prairie Acquisition and Restoration Fund, and we're really, really excited about it. So it's a new partner for us, and something that we're feeling very excited about. I know we're running behind, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but I did want to show you some pictures on the first page of some of our past restorations that were done utilizing the methods that I talked about. The seed for these projects was purchased from the private seed industry. Some of the projects started in 1998, and at that time we weren't necessarily labeling for the location or the origin of the seed, but we were careful to purchase products that we felt would do well in the area and were plants that were native to the area. And some of the results are as you see in these pictures. Again, it was a great partnership to put this stuff together, and we utilized a lot of local services. The costs of these restorations that you're seeing here at the time of planting had a seed budget of about $200 per acre. The next page is some wetland edge type restorations, and the club is just getting started on that, so these are actually on my own land. The cost of wet prairie restorations, seed is sort of a newer science. Seed's a little harder to come by. And these restorations that you're seeing here ran about $600 an acre in seed. And of course, there were other costs for seeding and site prep and management. I also, as a local sponsor, we tried to put together our plans for our new piece of land. The very last part is the upland seeding plans that we're working with. And you know that the language that we're getting from the agencies is evolving, and it is a sort of frustrating process. you do feel like you put a lot of work into something and then you didn't quite meet this or you didn't quite meet that standard. And it is putting a lot more time and pressure to volunteer. It is something that I struggle with and have thought about maybe it's time to hire a consultant. But we put together the plan that you have before you. It's a 38-species upland plan. Maybe a little more diverse than the pictures that I showed, but in that same ballpark. I did try to source the seed first, and the way I have in the past from the nurseries that I purchased in the original pictures, and found that most of the seed did originate in the state, most of it within 200 miles. A lot of it within about 120 miles. But within 200. I did then go on two websites and look for the closest source, yellow tag seed. And within the county, because that was the sequencing that was in the language when I started this process, I found 11 species that would meet that criteria. One upland grass and the rest were flowers. So then I went out to the ecoregion and then out to the neighboring ecoregions. In the end, the seed was very close to where we started, as far as what was available. I don't have the updated cost yet to try to get the closest seed. I did request that from the nurseries. But I think one of the struggles with closest source, at least for me, I would rather have a radius in which to work with, mostly because I'm a bargain hunter, and I would like to be able to negotiate with the nurseries that I have a long-term trust relationship with to be able to get the best price. And that's how we've been able to do things reasonably in the past. Closest source means to me that we pay whatever that closest source is. And it's also been a struggle for me because my background is in soils, and the closest source does not always match the soils as well as some sources that are further away, just simply because of where we're at right now and the seed availability. And I hate losing that kind of flexibility. But that's from my perspective, and that's what I want to share with you today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Mueller? Not. Thank you. Thank you very much. Ms. Stanihill, could you come down now and give us an update on the Conservation Partners Program? And if you could start out, we really need some clarity about how these guidelines or requirements, I guess is a better term, that you've included in this handout came to be.
Thank you. The handout came to be because I was trying to figure out how to implement the language in the chapter law. We got some questions from field staff saying just how do we know if the seed people want to provide with meets the language? What can we use to test it against or to look and say, yeah, this fits the language to make sure that we handle it properly? So I went back and looked what what I'd written in the RFP was a little too stringent. Some of the guidelines were requiring yellow tags, which was wrong. So I revised it to this new updated seed guideline that you have now. And basically, to make sure people know what we're looking for, we list all the section law. And then it said, in order to meet the requirements, we want you to document your attempts to meet them, obtain approval from the public land manager or easement holder for to use that vegetation or seed, and provide written documentation of where that came from, just so we have it for our file. And then we started getting into more of the details about the actual seed itself. And to clarify this and further develop it, I worked with our DNR staff and Bowser staff. Dan Shaw from Bowser was with me today to help answer more of the technical questions and explain how they come up with their guidelines. And also worked with Jason Garms, who is our prairie specialist at DNR. They're real helpful and can provide a lot more detail from I knew. So it took a lot of language from what Dan had for Bowser's projects. And if you look at the language in there, just about every point in here has some flexibility, such as 150 miles is recommended as a maximum distance. On the backside, suggested seed mixes are available. Substitutions of individual species are acceptable if they meet the intended goals of a project or program and are approved by the land managers. Avoid the use of cultivars. use as high diversity as possible and protect reducing prairies to the extent possible. And as the seed industry folks did reference, we do reference the NRCS practice standards as one of the documents that provide guidelines for the use of native prairies and season plants. And Dan,
could you introduce yourself again? Who you're with?
Dan Shaw with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I'm a vegetation specialist. I have two handouts that I'll pass around. Mr. Chair, members of the council, two handouts that I'm passing around. One is the draft guidelines that we've been developing at Bowser. One is the map of ecological exceptions and subsections that goes along with those guidelines. We've been working on developing new guidelines for the Bowser program. The process started last May to start collecting input from growers, from other agencies, both federal and state, and trying to work to develop a new standard that also addresses the new legislative language that we have. Some of the key points that are in that language focus on local ecotype, trying to find local ecotype seeds, using a high diversity of species that originate from as close to a restoration site as possible, and protecting existing native prairies from genetic contamination. And so that applies all about our programs. And so that was some of the starting point that we had as far as developing this new standard. And so that weighed in pretty heavily as far as trying to develop a standard that could work for the growers as well as work for the agencies, all the partnerships that we would be working with through the state. And the new standard covers diversity levels, seed mixes, seed source requirements, yellow tag, seed use, native variety use, seed labeling, and methods to protect existing prairies and seed production areas. So those are all headings on the guidelines that we're passing out. The process for developing this is that we did start seeking input in May, asking growers and others what should be in a standard like this based on the new language. As you can imagine, the feedback varied quite a bit as far as what we were getting, as far as what an acceptable distance should be for obtaining seed, ranging from within the same county to 200-300 miles distance for that seed source. We did develop a draft in August. That draft was sent out to all the growers, again to federal and state agencies for another review, and that resulted in this current draft, which we've sent out one more time to even a larger audience, including some university professors, different DNR divisions, and then local government units that will be using the standard. So we're still getting a few more comments. We're getting pretty close to the point of finalizing it. So some of the wording in the standard was used for the LASARD grant and incorporated into that grant. For the most part, most of the guidelines, there was consensus on them, which I think in some respects was surprising in a way, but there was a lot of consensus. Where there was still some disagreement was with source distance and to some extent with variety use, though we do adjust that in this standard that some varieties are fine if they are meeting the source requirements for the program. So future steps will be incorporating the new comments that we received on the standard. We're also planning to combine Bowser, MnDOT, and DNR seed mixes this fall, and so we'll be using the standard potentially along with MnDOT specifications for those new state mixes that we're developing. Planning to develop a standardized way to adapt those state mixes as needed for sites, and then combine these standards with the Minnesota Wetland Restoration Guide that we've been working on, and other guidelines that we're using for programs. And then hoping to also continue bringing state and federal standards closer together. So that's where we're at with this standard. We're getting near the end, trying to set the specifics of it. There's a lot of discussion of 150 miles. We felt that we needed a specific distance. We are focusing on, as the legislative wording states, trying to find seat as close as possible, also using depot-type regions to the extent possible, but we felt we needed still a defined range that would be the maximum that people could use for our community.
Questions?
No, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. During your looking into all the standards that you talked about with the groups, have you looked at the NRCS practice standard at all? You may have said that.
Yes, I met with Mark Oja, who's the state biologist for NRCS, and the hope is, our hope is trying to keep standards as consistent across the state for the standards that have been used. And they're in the process of updating the 643 standard. But they were sticking with the 200-mile radius. Most of the comments we were receiving from agencies and some of the growers was to have less distance for that maximum. One thing that definitely weighed in was the legislative wording also that, you know, we're trying to find it as close as possible, and so we kept referring back to that language to provide some guidance for us, and so we decided that 200-mile range was further than we felt comfortable with based on the language and other things.
Bill? Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as Darby had said, and I think it's very important, when you disagree with that 200-mile standard, is that based on science? Obviously, it must be.
Sean? There has been research that's been conducted. There isn't a lot of research out there. Research that has been done on certain species, and a lot of it isn't real conclusive, but there have definitely been studies. Ruth Shaw from the university has done some recent studies looking at species and showing that there can be genetic influences if species are moved too far in their range. And I think a lot of that comes down to that. It will likely vary depending on the species. Some species are wind dispersed. Others are dispersed by other means. And so the dispersal of individual species should be weighed in also, that it's hard to make generalization across the board. And that's where some of the research that Rochelle was looking at, what some of those species had limited dispersal mechanisms, and so genetics might be a bigger factor if seed is moved very far. And so that was definitely something we did look at, is what is the available research.
Jim?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I just have two questions for Leslie. Did you run this by any of the people sitting behind you, the private industry, at all, and ask them their opinion on this document? And also, did you run it by any local conservation groups to ask them their opinion of this document?
No, I did not. I ran it past Jason Garms, Dan, a couple of our field staff, and that was the extent of it.
Darby?
Thank you, Mike. My wife and I have decided that we're going to put some prairie, a small little chunk of prairie, and some property that the city gave up as it was going to be a road right away. And so I've been quite interested, kind of on a very personal level. And what I did last night was to take a 100-mile radius, and I had, it seems like the prairie restoration is the closest seed source to where I live. And so I took a compass and I drew a 100-mile radius from Princeton, and I also did the same for Glendon. Apparently, prairie restoration has two seed-producing sites. And I was greatly impressed with the acreage that compass laid out, and I'm wondering, that's just two seed producers. How many seed producers are they, and how far apart are they? And I mean, is that the issue, that we just got not enough geographic distribution of producers?
Yeah, I'm not sure the exact number. There's quite a few numbers.
Do you know the number of the growers?
A dozen or less,
let's say. That's a different group than ours.
So There's a Native Wildflower and Grass Producers Association and a number of the Northern Association. And so they're distributed around the state. There's certain areas of the state that I think are covered a little better than other areas. And so if you're around the Princeton area, prairie restoration will have more local seed to get out, you know, around maybe central Minnesota, there might be less source out there. So it will vary. I think there are gaps, but I think the growers are doing a good job of starting to fill some of those gaps. We've had requirements for local seed for a while based on the 8402 wording for like a native buffer program and also for RAM. And so that, I think, has been influenced in the market somewhat as far as trying to strive for more local seed sources. And so I think there's more available than there was. In our guideline, we're saying that yellow seed cake needs to be used if it is available. And so that's one way to have the source verified and stress that, you know, we're looking for source-specific seed. And yellow cake seed seems to be a lot more available than it was a few years ago. Minnesota Crop Improvement Association posts a survey on their website listing how much seed is available, and that's really referred to that in our guidelines.
Dave?
You know, I think this is an interesting discussion. If you interleave it with what's going on in terms of climate change, it seems to me it becomes almost irrelevant. The 100 miles, 25 miles, 50 miles, whatever mileage you choose, if climate change is real, and I think the science is pretty conclusive that it is, limiting your selection to just stuff that's within any distance becomes bogus, because you're going to end up having stuff that won't grow in the area in which you're planting it, depending on how fast climate change happens and what happens to the environment in that. And so what do you do about that? You know, you create these rigid guidelines, and then all your guidelines are basically going to throw you into chaos when you filter in climate change. How are we supposed to make smart decisions in face of that?
I think these guidelines will just have to adapt in the future. They'll have to
don't we have to deal with that today? I mean, climate change is coming. Nobody's arguing about that. We don't know what extent it is, and we're making decisions on what's best today, knowing that climate change is coming, but limiting ourselves to local ecotype, however you define it. Aren't we doing ourselves a disservice to not be looking at where we're likely to go and planning for that now?
Stan Hill, Mr. Cole.
How do you put that into a program requirement? And how do you make it something that we could say, yeah, our grantees met that?
So we do it wrong because it's hard?
Ellen?
Well, I don't want to get into a long debate, but I guess the only comment I would make, David, is that as with climate change, I think protecting diverse species and genetic differences becomes more important than ever, because we're losing species quickly. And so, yes, you have to figure out how adaptation will work, but you can't just say, shrug your shoulders and say, we're going to lose all these species anyway, so why bother? I guess
I'm saying, how do we filter in what's going to come and make sure we're not making bad decisions today based on what we're facing in the future?
Scott?
The question I have is for Leslie. It sounds, to the extent possible, try to get your seed within 150 miles. If they do a project and the seed is coming from 200 miles away, will that be reflected in their scoring process as to whether the grant gets funded or not? Or will those seed sources, I mean, the guidelines are there, the recommendations are there, will the people that are ultimately deciding the grants dig into the actual length or distance that the seed came from when they score the grant?
I doubt it, because it's a good chance that the applicant won't know exactly. My guess is most applicants will write, we will meet to the extent possible this language here, And so they will say that we'll try to meet that. It'll come through when they actually start to implement their projects that, okay, we can't find the seed within 150 miles, but we've got it within 200. Then they should go to the land manager and say, is this okay? And if it's okay, then they can move on. I don't think most applicants will know exactly their seed source when they submit the application by November 3rd.
Rick? I think somewhat to answer David's question about protecting the remnants. Our whole challenge here is that there's not much left of these remnants. And so they could be in areas in the state where there's only a small pocket left. But the legislature has decided, and I understand the frustration and the complexity and the change here, is trying to build that margin and protect what we have and to make sure that we can provide the basis for the science. And so if we have climate change, maybe the adaptability of a local ecotype to move or be used 100 years from now, we need to protect that source now. I think the thing to try to come back to is that there are all kinds of land management decisions and all kinds of restorations out there. We're talking about the money that's used from the Constitution that says to protect, restore, and enhance birds. And so there is, I think, from the legislature, that when we use the state money, we want to include the science, make sure that we are trying to protect our resource, trying to expand that resource. NRCS guidelines can be used for all the CRP, hundreds of thousands of acres. I mean, it's been used and it will be used. NRCS guidelines are very slow to change. I think you would agree on that. It's very, very slow to change. It's glacial in terms of trying to change NRCS guidelines. So when we have the opportunity now, when we're using state money and we're using constitutional money, we should try to protect and enhance what we have and make sure that we're using those local sources, because the genetic gold mine that we have, some of it's on state land, some of it's on private land, but to try to protect that so we have that ability to respond in the future.
Wes? Leslie, just a comment. She showed up at Curtis Falls, had a great presentation. We had, 40 people show up for the meeting on the small grants, and it was a good turnout. One of the things that I see, it's just like diversity, seed mixes and so forth. You've got a tremendous scientific-based staff in the field that we go out and look at what's out there and what are we going to do the restoration. We've got some remnants of about 40 acres of remnant native prairies. We're not going to mix a 20-mix variety in there. We're going to look and see what happens after we remove the woody cover, the sumac, the prickly ash. And we're going to look at the base that's there, probably do the burn, and then add maybe warm season grass like the big blue, probably the Indian grass to add some diversity to it, but don't go in and try to put a 20 mixture on top of that. Selectively look and see what we've got, and we've got the capability out there to look at that and do that, and to put a blanket request on that. It has to be a 20 variety mix in there. Kind of gets off base a little bit. So utilize some of the base that's in the field, the scientific expertise that's out there. There's a lot of it. We can do a good job in working without tying our hands too tight on very strict restrictions.
That's why we added the wiggle room of the, as possible, and ask people to meet their site and do things that's appropriate for that site and the program.
Ellen, I'd like to wrap this discussion up so we can get an update of the program itself, but last
okay.
word, Ellen.
All right, sorry then, because I just, I don't want to pontificate too much, but, I've been teaching lately, and it's been really fun because it means I have to learn a lot more. And I've been reading about resiliency, and something I'm sure you know a lot more about. As a forestry professor. But anyway, I think that the benefit of having genetic species that are adapted, that are best adapted to a site and diverse, allows them to be more adaptable to change. And I think that that's beneficial just for a lot of reasons. So the other thing, I just wanted to follow up to what Scott said. And I think what I heard from the growers was not so much that you can't find the seeds, but that they're going to cost more. And so I guess the question would be, how will that, just to follow up on what Scott asked, if someone puts in an application based on a restoration cost of a certain amount, how will that factor in? Because there may be an additional cost, there may be a few percent more dollars involved per acre to do it the way that we're asking them to do it than they could do it otherwise. So how will that be factored into an application? Will you be looking at price ranges that reflect these requirements, or will there be a range available depending on how their seed sourcing turns out?
It's a tough one because we don't know what level of detail we're getting from the application. We do have a rough idea as to what pre-planting an acre of prairie costs. And you know, if they say they're going to be 20 species mix versus 10, you know, stuff is probably going to be more expensive because of that diversity. It's hard to tell. I'm not sure we have an answer for that, although we can, again, look at what their cost is, and if they specify in their application that here's what we found out so far, we can't find this seed, or it's coming from a long ways away, and this is causing us an increase, that would be the best way for us to justify any higher cost. Any thoughts on that, Dan?
I think that's a good point. I think, you know, the costs are, well, vary somewhat depending on the project. I think, you know, it's going to be a two-effective basis as far as the cost and how much you would have been able to spend. But hopefully things will evolve over time where some more seeds will become available, meeting local guidelines as well, and that, you know, we'll hopefully have a long-term plan sometime. So. Mr. Shaw, thanks for your comments. Ms. Tannehill, I'd appreciate it if you could stay up here and just give us a brief update on the small grants program. I guess this discussion, though, what I take away was there's a lot of confusion. We have parties that don't seem to be communicating fully with each other. And what I hear is that the department is certainly looking at their requirements as being somewhat permissive in terms of how you might source the seed. And I would encourage you to work with the folks behind you to make sure that you understand their concerns, and to the extent possible, you can incorporate those into your program. With that, I'd appreciate if you could give us a brief update as to where we are with the Conservation Partners Grant Program.
Two documents. The first one I'll address, I don't know where it's at. It's kind of a summary of the number of workshop meetings we had for potential applicants. It describes how many people were at each meeting and who they represented, although there are quite a few folks who represented more than one organization. For the grand total, we did 23 meetings throughout the state, and we had a total of 226 attendees. And those meetings started, the earliest one was September 28th, and the last couple ones were concluded on October 14th. So we were on the road quite a bit for the past couple of weeks. We had pretty good turnout, good interest. What we started out with was a PowerPoint presentation, kind of giving the background of the program and some program guidelines. And then we walked through the application system, including the forms that are required, and then walked through the actual online application system itself to show folks how it works. And generally had a pretty good response from that. Les was there that one time, and it was nice to have him talk and just be present for it.
Anything else?
Not on that, unless you have any questions on the
I guess the question I have, and it's a standing question, is what type of feedback, what type of inquiries are you getting from, you had these workshops, sounds like you had a fair number of people, what are you getting when the phone rings, who's calling you and what are they asking, what are they telling you?
Getting a pretty good variety. We took a lot of the questions we got from this workshop and put them up as FAQs on the website because they seemed to be coming up a lot. We had quite a few questions about land acquisition and easements. The big question was the constant clarification of
the restoration enhancement work, does it have to be on land under public ownership and permanent conservation easement? And just what is a permanent conservation easement? And then also, does that land have to be open to public hunting and fishing? Then another question, too, was about lands acquired acquisitions. Does the land that's acquired in easement have to be open to public hunting and fishing? And just some general uncertainty or unclarity about how the breakout of those requirements went. That was probably the most.
Of the people that attended these meetings, the 226, I mean, in general, I mean, the purpose of this program is to reach out to the conservation groups, the Mary Muellers of the world, who are doing this type of great habitat work. What percentage of them were from Rotten Gun Clubs, local conservation habitat groups versus government, or you know, local or state-level government individuals?
That's a good question. I did not do a breakout in that way. We had quite a few small conservation organizations come. We did have good participation by the Soil and Water Districts, and they are actively working with private landowners who have permanent conservation easements. They wanted to know how the program was run and just how things work. I honestly don't have a good breakout rate.
Any other questions? Scott, please.
Are you done with your overview, or we did? Because I can ask my question.
Questions. Now it's time for questions.
I've been talking about the workshop that specifically. I have some other information on other public relations we've done. Do you like the way?
Okay, let's finish up.
The second sheet you got was a report from our web team folks about what we've been seeing on our website and the hits we've gotten there. And I had to get educated on just all, what all this means, too. The page views, we actually have for the entire site, we had over about 4,500 site views. The unique page views represents the number of individuals that have accessed the site. It's not the number of times it's been accessed, but how many unique computers have gone to that site. The bounce rate is people that bounce away to a different site rather than continue working within our website. And no, that's where it came from. Sorry, contributed to. Bounce rate is the number of folks that go away to a different site from this, and then there's just the basic numbers of how many page views we got. The main page got about 3,000 hits. The application system, and this is through October 11th, had gotten 780, and you just look down the rest to see how long they're on the page, how many unique views there were, and other information about that. Summary of how the page website is. And our listserv now is up to about 850 people on there, so every time we send out an update, that's how many people get that. Currently, we have not received any applications, which is pretty much what we expected. We're not expecting to get them until the next week or so out from the actual deadline. So, other marketing that we've been working on is just basically continuing the announcements about the workshops. And I think we had a press release come out saying that the application system was up and running, so people knew they could go in and take a look at it, see what they need to do, play around with it some. And our field staff have been doing a heck of a lot of contacts out there with folks that they know, and just working with people that might be interested in the program and people who call in for more information. And for the grant selection process, we're working on setting up review committees to go through each of the habitat types. We'll break out the applications by wetland, forest, prairies, and then also one for acquisitions. And we're working with getting internal and external folks to work on the technical aspects of those and give us some rankings. Then our DNR division directors will take a look at the scoring that's developed by the technical committees, and our commissioner will make the final decision on how that works. And our goal is still to get that done by the middle of December.
Scott?
Well, I asked Leslie this question, and I'll ask it again so that the rest of the council can hear. And I'm familiar with as we all are, that the land's either got to be on public land or land that's in private ownership with a permanent conservation easement. And the question that I posed to Leslie was, if you've got a piece of 25-year-old rim property, it's a permanent conservation easement, the private landowner was compensated at that time for that easement, and that easement requires that that landowner maintain that property at a certain level of quality of habitat. And obviously there's a lot of those areas that have grown over with woody cover, they're degraded or whatever. And I know that down in the region that I'm from, Southwest Minnesota, they had 5 workshop meetings down there. I don't know that they were your workshop meetings. They were put on by Ken Barlin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they had meetings in the afternoon for government organizations and separate meetings in the evenings for conservation organizations, or at least they did that in order to get a vote. And the question that I asked Leslie, I said, if you have a 25-year-old rim property, which you were compensated for and required to maintain, and you did not maintain it, okay, if you're a soil and water conservation district, you're going to come to the legacy of small grants program and say, I've got a piece of property out here. It's in permanent conservation easement. It's terribly degraded. I want to apply for a grant to maintain that. And my question was that that private landowner has already been paid to maintain that. Are we going to fund those projects? You know, and I can see an exorbitant amount of those kinds of applications coming in. And the question I have is how will you deal with those in comparison to other projects when the landowner was already paid to maintain that project when they enrolled?
You know, I didn't know the answer to that question. I wasn't experienced with it. I checked around with the staff that I could find, but the information I got was that very few of those early rim easements and other easements were included paying the landowner upfront for long-term maintenance. Most of them paid for establishment, and I don't know whether or not the maintenance was in that, but that was the information I got from Bowser staff. So in that case, if they weren't paid upfront to maintain the property for the length of the easement, I don't see that there's an issue. They should have kept it up, sure, but they didn't for whatever reason. And I don't have any language that says I cannot grant something out to improve that habitat now.
Is that a one-time deal? I mean, if they apply for a grant and you feel that they're eligible, will they ever be able to come back again, or will you then consider that they've been paid to manage?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I think the bigger question, there's two questions that come to mind. If there's a piece of property that the state owns the development rights and the habitat rights to, and the landowner has that responsibility, and the land's in very degraded condition, the state shouldn't be stepping in and saying, this is your obligation. I don't think the decision is whether they've been paid. The question is whether or not, in the conveyance of those rights, the landowner assumes the management and habitat responsibility. Whether or not they were compensated or not, it seems to me, is irrelevant. It's whose responsibility is it to maintain that habitat?
I don't know that answer. So are you saying that, therefore, just for my guidance in running the grant program, should I not allow those to be done? Kevin, would you like to comment from Bowden?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, council members. I'm Kevin Lyons, the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And specifically to the question existing rim reserve, the process that's in place that has been since 1986 is that the landowner that we purchase a conservation easement from, it's permanent, and it's the tie back to the conservation plan that's developed for the specific property. The landowner is responsible for maintaining the conservation provisions in the plan. That's their responsibility into the future. The question, I think, or the discussion here is that when RIM was created in 1986 and we were not using necessarily native vegetation, at least not requiring native vegetation, a lot of brome and other grass species and other, you know, conservation practices were installed at that time. Not obviously the case today. Best science, the board beginning in 1998 established native vegetation as a requirement on a RIM reserve program, so that has evolved. So I think the question here is that if you have an existing rim reserve easement and it's maintaining the premise of the conservation plan, then certainly that's not a requirement. I think the question here for the council would be, are you interested in looking at any enhancement potential on that property? And then that question, I think, could certainly look at enhancing from a conservation plan that was developed 25 years ago, because the program began in 1986, but some time ago, and has the best science evolved to today, and we'd want to be having standards of today. So that's what we could be possibly looking at. I think the second question of that, we do, Bowser does have funds have been appropriated to the board and the Rim Reserve Program for enhancing existing easements now, and we are looking for those kind of projects as we speak. So when Leslie has indicated to us that she's getting requests like this, we certainly contact the local stormwater conservation district, and there is a process that we have for looking at an enhancement potential on that project.
Les, and then Bob, and then Scott.
I'll divert. You had one that was right on your mind. Go ahead.
Well, Bob is next.
Oh.
Okay, Scott.
Well, and the question I have for you is obviously you have old rim properties that were planted to grow. Okay, they could be enhanced or improved. But you can take a current rim property that's only 5 or 6 years old, okay, that's planted in best management practices that needs burning. Okay, can these people? I mean, I'm struggling. I am. My parents are own 14 acres of property that currently has a Des Moines River crop easement on it. Okay, and when they signed it, it says right in there, you're going to maintain it. Now, whether that's planted in the old days brome or this one's planted in native grasses, 5 or 6 years from now, it's going to need a berm. Okay, I don't perceive that that a private landowner can come to our small grants program and say, I signed on, I got a responsibility, now I'd really like you to pay for it, okay? And so I don't see, I foresee our grants program getting deluged with private landowners who have habitat management responsibilities, who have not done those, who now want our grants program to pay for it, which I would adamantly oppose. And my question comes down to is, if Scott Rawls' new Des Moines River Crest project falls in disarray, someone will show up at that property and say, Mr. Rawls, you need to do something about that. And that will become an enforcement problem with me, not a apply for a grants handout, you know, which is what's being considered with all of those other properties that are out there now. And I think that we need to get a real good grip on what, I mean, I like I said, I can see 300 applications to do private landowner easement habitat restorations on property that they were required to maintain anyway. I think that's something we have to address and be very, very cognizant of.
Mr. Chair, council members, I would agree exactly with your assessment there, Mr. Rawl. It is the responsibility of the landowner that we purchase a conservation easement to maintain that property. If he wants to do a prescribed burn following the establishment and of the original management plan, that is the responsibility of the landowner, and I'm not advocating anything different than that. Now, I think the question of the council is, in your case, that's a relatively recent practice, but there would be older easements that there might be benefits, in fact, for the state to look at that. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying there could be benefits for something.
One of the things that we've talked about a lot is using easements instead of acquisition, because it doesn't require the state to pay any dollars for maintenance. That becomes the landowner obligation. And if we move forward on one side of the page saying we like easements because when there's no pilt payments, there's no ongoing obligation, and then we turn around in our small grants program and fund that, okay, we're really not achieving the goal that easements provide in our overall plan.
Follow up on that point. Are those programs that you administer, are they upfront dollars, the 10-year programs, or are they paid yearly? And if they're up front, how do you enforce? Go through the enforcement mechanism here for one that Scott is talking about that needs to be burned, that's not burned. What action can you take against that property?
So, Mr. Chair, council members, first off, it would be an upfront payment that's paid for the landowner for the conservation easement acquisition, whatever the payment rate, and subsequent conservation practice costs as well. Depending upon that, if we have a partnership such as RIM-WP, something like that, that could vary on that, but if it was just standalone RIM. Our inspection and monitoring process is we do an annual inspection the first 5 years after recording of the easement and establishment of the original conservation practice. So very rigorous inspection process. Following that, once every 3 years, the easements are annually inspected. That's on a database where we contact the local soil and water conservation district. So those are inspections are taking place somewhere. We do anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 inspections annually based on our 5,200 easements that we've recorded in the state of Minnesota in the last 23 years. So we have a very up-to-date and current database on our easement practices, and we have very few violations or non-compliance issues outside. Certainly noxious weeds is a problem anywhere in the state, but we do have an inspection and monitoring process, and if in fact the Soil and Water Conservation District determines that in fact there's a non-compliance or an issue related to the easement, then the landowner is notified, identified of the problem, and then they have to go about seeking correction of that problem or whatever it might take. It's handled simply beginning with the local Soil and Water Conservation District, which the landowner would then work with. Hopefully we get compliance and the actions are remedied depending upon the activity. But if, of course, it gets bumped up to my office, ultimately we would serve the Attorney General and seek the counsel of the Attorney General and seek legal action on the easement. So we take the compliance on our easements is extremely serious, and you know we have, I think, an outstanding record of accomplishment.
Any other questions focusing back on the Conservation Partners Program, because we do need to move on. Les?
Quick one, Mr. Chair. This is a question for you, Leslie, and maybe it's for the council. In a lot of counties, we do not have the local talent available, but in many, many counties, we do have the local talent, and we're referring to the MCC as the organization that's going to come in and do some of the projects. I'm just kind of wondering where we came to that conclusion that the MCC can do it better, or is it a first choice of choice in doing the projects. In our county, we've got 28 sportsmen's clubs. We were going to go to the sportsmen's clubs and let them take the responsibility, let the local contractors take the responsibility, and keep it based. And most of that labor that's involved in the restoration project is going to be done locally and donated. Now, I'm trying to, you know, the question has been asked, why is the MCC the first and front row source here? I don't know where that came from.
I don't know either. It's simply in Chapter 172, and it's something that anybody who gets funds are required to make timely written contact with MCC. So in order to help our grantees out and make sure they meet that requirement, we put it in as part of our program and tied it in their application so they can do that. There's no requirement that they actually use MCC. It's just that they meet the timely written contact with MCC. And we're asking folks to document that and keep proof that they have made that contact in their file in case there are questions.
Scott?
The one last closing statement is more directed to the council. Leslie, pose the question. Do we perceive that a restoration effort on a permanent easement privately held, whether we think that that's a fundable grant or not? I think that our council should provide her the guidance. Obviously, my opinion is on the table. I think it's important that the council give their overall view on that.
Well, a couple ways to answer that. I think you've heard individual opinions. I will just be very upfront, council members. I'm really reluctant to have the council give advice to the department on this, and the reason being is that we, in our appropriations language to the legislature, had a role as an advisory committee, if you recall. That was stricken out for whatever reason by the legislature, that we were taken out of playing an advisory role on the implementation of this program. And so I am really reluctant to get back into the game of advising them on a formal basis because of that role.
Just as a follow-up to that, I think that what this does is helps us determine how we're going to write future appropriations if we have a future appropriation. This will be something we need to discuss.
Yeah. That's right. Any further comments?
No, questions? Thank you for the question.
Thank you very much. Bill?
Public input period. I've received no yellow cards and no one has contacted me by the deadline, but I'd like to offer to anyone in the audience who wants to take a few short minutes to come down and say something. So if you'd like to do that, raise your hand. Seeing no hands raised.
Okay, logistics, Bill.
You need to adjourn the meeting.
Yes, so the business meeting, motion to adjourn the business part of the meeting for the discussion. Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting, this meeting is adjourned.
The bus is out in front. The lunches are on the bus. Someone can grab the cooler underneath the handout table. Those are the journeys. I've got to clean this room up, so I would suggest that people visit the restroom at this point in time. We'll meet out in front. We have a very tight bus. Rick Hansen is driving, incidentally.
Driving the bus?
No.
That's why you're worried about accidents.
On the bus, I have listed Patrick McCormick, Greg Knopf, Les Judge, Jim Cox, Mike Kildor, Ellen Anderson, Darby Nelson, David Hartwell, Scott Hall, Bill Ingebrigtsen, myself, Joe Persinka, Julie Blackburn, Brian Watson, Bob Welch, Dirk Peterson, Michelle Hansen, Sarah Strowman, Al Singer, and Bob Bechter, and that's 20.
No, it's fine. There's a lot of people.
Until we get some projects on that, it's really hard. It's like what else is in mind. We talk about a match, you know, but when it comes into putting this in practice, it's really hard. We talked about something with the last week, right there on Buffer stuff. I can probably can't deal with them because they don't have the authority to recommend. They can be cheerleaders and say, oh, that's not great. Feed it to you, and then you can recommend.
We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the professor is very interesting. Alan asked me to come.
It was one of the more frustrating ones. It's not our program. And I didn't bother to talk to him. These are classic examples. They just talk to one another. You know, DNR said, well, we see this is pretty flexible.